Good Thursday to you. Welcome to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host. We've got a fantastic show for you. Very busy today. Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy going to join us in just a little bit. Talking about the latest violence in Chicago, among the latest violence in Chicago, a would-be rapper shot and killed while rapping about guns there in the Windy City. Katie Moyer, political writer in Pennsylvania. She's got a piece at Penn Live, the online site for the Harrisburg newspaper. She says Americans might be angry, but where to go from that? Well, we can't just stay angry forever and just shake our fists forever and ever. We have to move on from that at some point? Huh. Wonder when that'll happen. We'll talk about it again with Katie Moyer later on in the hour. She, of course, is right there in the thick of things now that the primary season has moved to Pennsylvania. She saw Bill Clinton today, and she has seen Donald Trump tonight. So we'll talk with Katie later in the hour. About an hour from now, my colleague Jenny Simone here at NRA News has a special report, a constitutional crisis. She's going to join us. We're going to share a clip from her new report. You can access it online at NRANews.com anytime on demand. But she's going to join us to talk about an hour from now. Also, next hour, Frank Miniter of Forbes says that gun industry executives might be deposed in the Sandy Hook lawsuit that is taking place. Frank also has a piece out at Forbes right now. The new $20 bill is making gun rights advocates and conservatives cheer, which I don't know, because Salon said that like everybody on the right is all outrageously outraged about it. I haven't seen any evidence of outrageous outrage. We didn't talk about it on the show yesterday because it's supposed to happen in like 2030, honestly. It's 2016 right now. We have a hard enough time paying attention to things that are going to be taking place, let's say, a month or two down the road. So I figured in the grand scheme of things, wasn't a huge story. I happen to think it's kind of cool. I do hope that they're going to have Andrew Jackson on the back of the 20, which to me doesn't make any sort of sense, given that the number one Google search term yesterday was, who was Harriet Tubman? Maybe you'd want to have, I don't know, a scene from Harriet Tubman's life if she's going to be on the $20 bill. But anyway, there is this assertion, and I called it Potemkin journalism. Salon is exhibiting this here, of let's create this narrative, let's craft this story, let's create this little Potemkin village, not based on truth, but based on what our audience wants to hear, and that is that conservatives and people on the right were so ticked off about this, because how dare you take a paragon of conservatism like Andrew Jackson off the 20 and replace him with a gun-owning Republican who fought for individual freedom and liberty. I mean, how awful. Oh. Again, I'm not seeing any evidence that people are actually hurt. Frank's piece at Forbes says, no, actually, on the other hand, conservatives, Second Amendment activists, they're cheering about this. Yeah. I hope it actually inspires and prompts people to learn more about Harriet Tubman. And in turn, to learn more about that time period in history. And then perhaps in turn, to learn more about other time periods in American history. I hope that this will inspire people to learn more about our shared national story. And Harriet Tubman was a badass. There's just no getting around it. So we'll talk with Frank next hour. Dennis Santiago, Dennis Talks Guns, joining us, discussing what happened in Sacramento yesterday, where a whole host of anti-gun bills cleared a Senate committee. We'll also talk about his latest piece, Armed Crime Deterrence in Metropolitan America, Making the Patchwork More Transparent. Paul Bedard of the Washington Examiner in Hour 3 with the latest on Hillary Clinton yesterday, saying that we have too many guns. Let's talk about guns, she said, with too many guns. And she didn't say what the right number of guns would be, just that we have too many. She didn't say what she would do exactly to reduce the number of guns. She has offered up her support for Australia's compensated confiscation before, but she didn't get specific about it. But in Hillary's eyes, the problem is, in this country right now, we have too many guns. Keep in mind, again, that for a number of years, but particularly, let's say, since 2008 or so, gun sales have been robust while violent crime continues to drop. But Hillary Clinton says we have too many guns. That's why we have an epidemic of gun violence, as she described it. Now, again, crime is at historic low levels. The Brennan Center for Justice just had a piece yesterday. We talked about on the show about crime in 2015. And, yes, crime did spike in a few cities. But overall, across the nation, at least in the 30 largest cities, crime continued to decline. Violent crime increased, I think they said, by 3.1%, but remain, again, at historic lows. And let's say Los Angeles. Aggravated assaults in Los Angeles amount for more than half of the nationwide increase in violent crime in the nation's 30 largest cities. Now, has anybody got to make the case that Los Angeles doesn't have enough gun control? They're sitting around trying to dream up laws that they don't already have on the books. And they're coming up with things like, well, if you have one of those magazines that we banned 20 years ago, if you still have one of those, you can't anymore. You have to turn it in. You have to give it up. And if you're a legal gun owner and you're a handgun owner, you got to have that handgun stored locked up unless you're carrying it on your person there in your home or it's under your direct control. That's where they're at in Los Angeles now. Okay? Because basically all of the gun control laws you could possibly want to put in place, is it easy? Is it more than theoretically possible to get a concealed carry license, for instance, in Los Angeles? No, not unless you're a celebrity, not unless you're a connected politician. No. Average person in L.A., you're not going to get a concealed carry license. With the passage of the quote-unquote assault weapons ban, and they're back at it again, by the way. Now they want to make it even more draconian. They're once again arbitrarily changing the definition of what a quote-unquote assault weapon is. Again, you've got a lot of gun control laws on the books in L.A. and in California. The Brady campaign says they've got the best gun laws in the nation. And yet half of the nation's increase in violent crime last year can be attributed to an increase in aggravated assaults in Los Angeles. But sure, another gun law, that's going to be the one that does the trick. Because we have too many guns out there. There's another story. Oh, by the way, we're going to talk with Kurt Schlichter in Hour 3 as well. But there's another story here. I thought about using this for our deal of the day, but no. Fox 13 in Winter Haven, Florida, I believe. Police call him a dangerous criminal who has 9 felony arrests under his belt. Now he's wanted for allegedly firing into an occupied Winter Haven home, and he's only 14 years old. Witnesses identified 14-year-old Roselle LaMichael Stephine as the gunman, and police have issued a warrant for his arrest. It was Monday night, police say, when they were called to home on Avenue C in response to shots fired into said home. A child had reported the sound of gunfire outside. Detectives say that they found a shell casing along with a flattened bullet that had gone through the front wall of the home and into a utility room. Fox 13 says the teen is no stranger to police. They say he has a history of felonies. Again, he's 14. He has a history of felonies that started with Grand Theft Auto when he was 11. He's also been arrested for burglary, robbery, credit card fraud, and more. The chief there in Winter Haven, Charlie Bird, says his prior arrests show an obvious disregard for the safety of any life, and it is imperative that we take him off of the street. He's 14. He has 9 arrests. We don't know how many convictions he has. Frankly, I don't even know if that information would be available since he's a juvenile. But suffice it to say that despite the lengthy criminal history of this 14-year-old, it doesn't seem, and again, despite the fact that the state, where Hillary Clinton says this is where all the solutions lie, lies within the state, right? The state is well aware of Roselle LaMichael Stephine. They are well aware of who he is. They are well aware of the trouble that he has caused. They are well aware that he is likely to cause trouble again. They are well aware of him. He is on their radar. And what does that even matter to this 14-year-old? You know, he's at the age where supposedly we can help him. The system can teach him not to do the things that he's doing, can try to turn his life around. What exactly are we doing? How is this system working? Because it seems like the system is broken if you've got a 14-year-old who continually keeps getting arrested for felonies. And the system's response seems to be, well, put him back out on the street. Maybe we'll double up his counseling sessions. And if he doesn't show up, then nothing will happen. You know, Hillary Clinton cannot even talk about criminals committing crimes. She talks about guns committing crimes, right? Guns from Vermont committing crimes in New York. She can't talk about criminals. Washington Free Beacon today had a story she was talking about. We need to have positive gangs, she said. Positive gangs. And what's fascinating is that in her comments, she acknowledges that the reason why we are seeing, we've known this. One of the reasons why young men join gangs is because of the bonds, the emotional connection that they get, that they often don't have at home. And Hillary Clinton sort of acknowledges this. But she doesn't talk about the need to have those functioning family structures at home. She's in Connecticut talking about gun violence. And she said, you know, joining a gang is like having a family. That's a substitute for having a family in many ways. It's feeling like you're part of something bigger than yourself. So we're either going to have gangs that murder and rob and do the things that are so destructive to the gang members and to the community, or we're going to have positive gangs. We're going to have positive alternatives for young people. And apparently that's what we need. How do we get positive gangs? What will they be doing? I kind of envision like the Boy Scouts and JROTC and programs like that as positive gangs in that sense. But Hillary Clinton just throws out any need for the real thing. Well, why do we have people joining gangs? Because they're like a family. Okay, well, apparently Hillary's acknowledged the family's toast because she doesn't talk about the family. She just talks about, the simple thing of restructuring gang society in the United States. And maybe just get these cartel members. Listen, can you stop selling heroin and, I don't know, flowers, maybe? Can you sell flowers? I mean, you're growing poppies. What if you just grew tulips in Mexico instead and you could just hand out flowers? These are very unserious statements by Hillary Clinton. But if you can't, again, acknowledge that criminals are committing crimes, not guns, if you can't acknowledge that cities in the United States with some of the most restrictive gun control laws saw some of the highest spikes in violent crime last year and have, for quite some time, been home to some of the highest crime rates in the country. If you can't acknowledge that in a city like Chicago, 6% of the population is at high risk of being the victim of a violent crime and also at risk of perpetrating a violent crime. If you can't acknowledge that, as the FBI has said, in some cities as many as 80% of violent crimes are committed by 20% of that city's gang population. If you can't acknowledge these realities, what's really taking place in these cities that are hard hit by violence, if you can't acknowledge the realities of what these gangs are and why they exist and the damage that they do, how can you seriously say that you're going to make anything better? All right. We're going to take a quick timeout. When we come back, Chip Everhart from Top Shot Academy is going to join us talking about the latest out of Chicago. Stick around. We've got more. NRA News, Cam and Company. A lot more still to come here on this edition. We'll be right back.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called blended learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills is just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day and half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there are 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself, Bill Poole. Thank you so much, sir.
Here's the truth about the Hollywood celebrities, political elites, and billionaires who attack the Second Amendment. The thought of average people owning firearms makes them uncomfortable. They don't like how the men and women who build their office buildings, vacation homes, and luxury cars, who mop their floors, clean their clothes, and serve their dinner, have access to the same level of protection as their armed security guards. They want you to surrender your freedom for a false promise of government-provided security they will never rely upon themselves. But no amount of money, power, or fame gives anyone the right to take our freedom away. At the core of the Second Amendment is the eternal truth that no life is more worthy of armed protection than another. That's what I believe, and that's what I fight for. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I emigrated from Venezuela, one of the most dangerous countries in the world today. A few years ago, the government came for our guns. We were told we would be safer without them. Of course, the politicians, the rich and famous, their bodyguards and criminals, they still have their guns. Everyone else lives in fear. Mothers and fathers are powerless to defend their families. But the drug cartels and gangs, the colectivos, still have all the guns they want, and 90% of murders are never solved. The biggest mistake Venezuelans made was believing that this could never happen. Today, they would do anything for the Second Amendment freedom that we enjoy as Americans. Never, ever take it for granted. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. And, yeah, this might be, like, one of the last big cultural moments that we all get to share together. The news that Prince passed away earlier today. And going to hear a lot of Prince songs, I think. He is going to be missed by a lot of folks. So Chip Eberhardt from Top Shot Academy with us on the program right now. Chip, how are you, sir?
Hey, Cam, I'm well. Really, thanks for having me on. Really surprised with news about Prince as well.
Absolutely. And, this news, I think, was shocking. The news out of Chicago of another musician who died, less shocking, unfortunately, because of the endemic violence in the city. But 23-year-old Damon Dawson, an aspiring rapper, was making a music video in a local park. It was about 2:20 in the morning. And apparently somebody came up behind the group, allegedly opened fire. Damon Dawson was killed. Four others were shot and wounded. And a, another rapper who goes by the name of Foreign Life said that there was a group of individuals gathered there to make the video for a song titled Two Techs and a 50-Shot Chip.
Yeah, amazing. That I mean, you know, we talked not long ago about, you know, the homicide rate in Chicago already being high and, you know, the gangs fracturing, you know, increased drug trafficking. And I hate to say it, but, you know, my revelation is that, you know, it's going to be a violent, hot summer is coming to fruition. This guy, Damon Dawson, also known as Thugga, interesting individual. Couldn't find a whole lot of information about him. It's interesting the way they use the language aspiring rapper, because there doesn't seem to be anything on him in the news other than about this story. There's nothing on YouTube. This guy, Foreign Light, interesting that he survived everything. And Dawson, what we do know about him from his aunt is that he dropped out of school in 11th grade. So what's he been doing since then? He's 23 years old. He's out at a park, supposedly shooting a music video at 2:20 in the morning. I've worked a lot with the Chicago Film Commission. I've even worked with them being a consultant when firearms are being used on set. And mm-hmm. it's not typical for them to give permits in a residential neighborhood at 2:20 a.m. for a music video to be shot. So this all is very, very suspect. Very suspect. But it does show just how violent Chicago's become.
It does. And, you know, you said you are concerned that this is going to be a violent summer. It seems like, you know, you've got a community right now that I think the last time we talked, Chip, there was a reporter who had gone out to Chicago and had done some reporting. I think it was for The Guardian. I think it was Lois Beckett. And she found this very clear split, you know, in these very hard hit communities where the number one thing that she heard about law enforcement were people saying, they need to be doing more, right? I want to see more of a presence here, which was closely followed by, no, they're doing way too much. And since that report came out, we've now seen this a commission established by Rahm Emanuel that has basically come out and said the Chicago Police Department has a history of systemic racism that persists to this day, which I can't imagine is going to do anything positive for the relationship between the cops and the community right now. There's been a lot of talk about the cops sort of going fetal, right? Trying to avoid any situation where, the cameras come out and, you know, all of a sudden they could get suspended for no reason or maybe for a justifiable reason. But it almost seems like we're reaching the point of dysfunction here when it comes to law enforcement in Chicago.
Yeah, total dysfunction and just, I mean, a lack of morale. I mean, with everything that's going on with media, with, you know, McCarthy, I'm no fan of his, but with him being, you know, thrown under the bus by the mayor, they really feel like they don't have any support. The police know that, you know, ultimately the mayor is their boss, you know, no matter who's in the seat of the superintendent. And now they really feel like they have no support. So as you say, going fetal sounds very accurate. I mean, how can you be, you know, motivated to do your job thinking that, you know, you're putting yourself at more risk by actually doing the job?
Absolutely. And, you know, if that's the case, then maybe, you know, you're not going to make stops. I know that the number of investigatory stops way down, at least in the first 3 months or so of the year. The city says that the numbers are starting to come up now. But, you know, summer is typically a more violent time, not just in Chicago, but around the country. There are more people out on the streets. The temperatures get high. I'm sure there are many factors, but historically that has been the case. Do you feel like the city, do you feel like, you know, talk about the leadership that, or the lack thereof from Mayor Rahm Emanuel right now as the city heads into the summer months?
Yeah, well, and that's just it. I think he's still really confused about how to act to this, and he doesn't seem to be doing anything good. It's interesting you bring about that. You know, summer months are more violent. I mean, that goes historically even back to before there was electricity, that the whole idea behind, you know, the full moon being a dangerous time because the full moon was the only time that people could, you know, prior to electricity could go out in the streets and actually see in front of their hand.
Mm-hmm.
So Yeah, so anytime, you know, in any city, when it's going to be warmer, as you said, there's going to be more people out, and there's going to be more violence, per se. But with Rahm, he's a politician, okay? That's all he is. He's not in touch with the people. He's not in touch with his department. He really doesn't know what he's doing, and it shows. There's a complete lack of leadership until he's replaced, I think, or at least smart enough to put the right people in place. Nothing's going to get better.
So, Chip, I got to ask. I mean, the continued violence in Chicago. We do know that there are folks out there who are getting their concealed carry license, including some good folks in really bad neighborhoods. As the summer weather comes and a lot of folks are thinking that we are going to see an increase in violence. Are you seeing an increase in the number of people who are looking for training and who are trying to get their concealed carry license there in Chicago?
Sadly, that is the trend. My wife loves it. She's like, yay, violence. I'm like, honey, we can't say that. But yeah, the phones, I mean, every time one of these incidents happens, yeah, people are starting to wake up, starting to get smart. And actually, I was just speaking to, by request, a Aquinas group in one of the suburbs here, and they were really interested, their membership, you know, who were service-driven, really interested in having the ability to defend themselves. So, yeah, I mean, I'm glad to say people are waking up. I'm sorry that it took all of this violence to bring that about.
Well, unfortunately, you know, but here's the thing. I think that you go back a few years, and clearly there was still that demand among, again, law-abiding residents who wanted to be able to protect themselves, but who couldn't. You know, it was just a few years ago that not only do we not have concealed carry in Illinois, but you had the handgun ban in Chicago that was completely ineffective at stopping violent crime, but it was pretty effective at stopping people who, you know, didn't want to go to jail for exercising a constitutional right. So I think that, you know, I think we are seeing an awakening there in Illinois, but there's also, because of the work of people like yourself and others around the state, like Valinda Rowe and Richard Pearson with the Illinois State Rifle Association, folks are able to wake up now because, you know, that it's a real right in a way that it wasn't, unfortunately, in the state of Illinois just a few years ago.
Yeah, and you mentioned a lot of the people whose shoulders we stand on, you know, having this right finally re-enabled in Illinois. I think of Mary Shepard, who was the lead defendant in the case. Shepard v. Madigan was what caused Judge Posner to pin that, you know, Chicago's blanket prohibition against law-abiding citizens carrying a concealed firearm in public institution.
Absolutely.
You know, the Mary Shepard story, you know, she was, you know, in her 70s. She's a volunteer at a church. You know, she had access to guns. She had training from guns. She had permits in other states, and she was brutalized. I believe it was October 2009. She was brutalized by a 6'3", 250-pound felon, I think it was. And, you know, fortunately, she survived, and she said, you know, that felon was not the only criminal in the room. The state of Illinois was the other criminal for denying her the ability to defend herself.
Yep. And because of her speaking out and speaking up and refusing to accept the status quo that said she didn't have a right to carry, you know, again, ultimately the legislature and the politicos in Chicago, they backed down. They didn't want to see this case go to the Supreme Court. Anti-gun advocates, I think, around the country didn't want Mary Shepard's case heard at the Supreme Court. And so they quietly acquiesced to a shall issue concealed carry law in Illinois. And, you know, again, you're right. There's Otis McDonald. I mean, there are no shortage of individuals who have worked to get y'all where you are. And, you know, at least now there is that opportunity for good folks in bad neighborhoods to be able to protect themselves and their families. I know that the work still progresses there, Chip, but y'all are again, you're doing a lot for our human right of self-defense and our right to keep and bear arms.
Yeah, I mean, and Cam, bless you for saying that. Human right, it really is, because, you know, a lot of times we talk about gun rights, but, you know, guns are inanimate objects. They don't have rights. They don't have emotions. But we as humans, we have rights, and one of our rights is to defend ourselves, and we should have the ability to do that.
Absolutely. Listen, it's always good talking with you, sir. I appreciate you coming on the program, and I hope we can do this again soon.
Hey, likewise. Thanks again.
Thank you, sir. Chip Eberhardt joined us from Top Shot Academy, talking about the latest going-ons in Chicago, Illinois. And I do worry, honestly, about the city of Chicago this summer as the violence increases. You know, they started off the year with a huge spike, doubled the homicide rate in 2015. And it really does look like you've got a city leadership that is more concerned with managing the headlines than and you know, massaging the egos that need to be massaged and playing the game as opposed to trying to fix a real serious problem here. And I've got my fingers crossed. I hope that the police and the community in these hard-hit neighborhoods can find a way to start working together, or else it is going to be a very long, hot summer, I think, in the Windy City. Katie Moyer is going to join us here in just a couple of minutes, talking about her piece in Penn Live. She says Americans might be angry, but where do we go from that? She's also paying very close attention to what's going on in Pennsylvania regarding the election season, hanging out with both Bill Clinton and Donald Trump today, Katie Moyer is. You know, we mentioned the passing of Prince a few minutes ago. There is another story, and it's out of the Twin Cities. It's not going to get anywhere near the coverage that the death of the musician Prince will get. But it is also worth talking about, especially here on this program. After spasm of deadly violence, St. Paul crafts response. That's the headline in the Twin Cities, where police say overall right now, they say aggravated assaults involving firearms are down a little bit compared to the same time last year. What they are concerned about is that they, too, are seeing a recent spike in violent crime. And the same basic causes there in St. Paul as we are seeing in Chicago. This is primarily gang violence that we're talking about. The response from the police in St. Paul is not, you know what, we need to have more gun control laws. The story in the Pioneer Press doesn't even mention that. They do talk about the need for more police officers as opposed to more gun control laws. I don't know that you're likely to hear Hillary Clinton in all of her policy prescriptions talk more about the need for gun control laws, or excuse me, she'll talk a lot about that, about the need for more officers on the street. She tends not to want to discuss the 1994 crime bill, with the exception of the gun ban that was included. That one she's happy talking about. For Hillary Clinton, it always comes back to the gun laws. But again, for the first responders, for the cops on the street, for the prosecutors, like those in California who are tasked with putting bad guys behind bars and who are opposed to these new rounds of gun control offered by Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, they're not calling for these measures. In fact, again, there is a growing willingness among a lot of these officials. California is a perfect example of this, where you've got a very broad coalition of the law enforcement personnel who are willing to actually say, you're going in the wrong direction. You keep aiming your legislation at legal gun owners, and you keep trying to make it harder to be a legal gun owner. You keep trying to restrict what it means to be a legal gun owner exercising your Second Amendment rights. And that's not the problem. We, the sheriffs, we, the prosecutors, we, the officers on the street, we're telling you what the problem is. Heck, we can name the problem for you in a lot of these neighborhoods. We can tell you specifically who the problems are, because there aren't that many of them, all things considered. In even the worst neighborhoods, there are more good people than bad living there. In even the worst neighborhoods, there are more people who are just trying to get through their day than there are individuals who are trying to make sure that somebody doesn't get through their day. But we don't want to focus on those individuals, at least the politicians like Hillary Clinton don't. They would much rather focus on the, 90 million gun owners in this country, the legal ones. They would much rather focus on the, 300 to 400 million privately owned firearms in this country, rather than, the 1.2 million gang members in this country. And if the FBI's reference held true a couple years ago, again, when they said that in some cities, as much as 80% of the violent crime can be by 20% of a city's gang population. That means that they would rather pay attention to the 80 million gun owners who aren't committing crimes, or the 90 million gun owners who aren't committing crimes, than the 250,000 gang members all across this country, in a nation of over 300 million people, who are responsible for perhaps a vast majority of the violent crime. This is what I can't figure out, at least when it comes to public safety. Now, if you don't like guns, you don't think people should be able to own guns, you don't like the Second Amendment, you think the Second Amendment should go away, then I suppose using public safety as a means to advance your argument makes some sort of sense. Not logical sense, but political sense. But for the good people living in those bad neighborhoods, who really do put their faith and their trust in Hillary Clinton that the next gun control law is going to be the one that does the trick, that's what still bugs me. Because I know good people who've lived in bad neighborhoods, who've been told, oh, it's the next gun law that's going to work. Problem is, we just don't have enough. Even though the gun laws that are in place are already enough to prevent most people from legally owning a gun. I know these empty promises. I know that they don't work. And sadly, you know, I think that maybe this is, I guess, maybe the one positive thing. I think that there are more and more people, good people in these bad neighborhoods, who are reaching that painful realization as well. All right, when we come back, Katie Moyer going to join us talking about the latest out of Pennsylvania. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up next.
Not difficult for readers or viewers to make that leap from a distrust of men to an inherent distrust of guns, and that's exactly what, you know, Everytown, Shannon Watts, and Newfound Besties at Cosmo want you to understand and take away from that.
Yeah, this is, what really concerns me is because this isn't an honest debate, and it's not an honest conversation.
No.
This is a branding campaign.
And, oh, my gosh, absolutely.
And, you know, what they are trying to brand is guns are not for women.
No, and I think that they're so used to pandering to a specific type of brand. You know, God forbid some of us women who want to take quizzes and see what scandal character we are, and that we do morning yoga, and we go to brunch with our girlfriends afterwards, God forbid we own firearms somehow, and we're now supposedly less than because we've educated ourselves and want to choose to take our self-protection seriously. Why is that so bad?
Well, I don't think it's bad at all. And, you know, it's interesting, Kimberly, because I think it may have been the same day that this video was released by Cosmo. There was the story, I know that you saw this out of Indianapolis, a young mom at home with her infant. Guy breaks in. Mm-hmm. She has a gun. She uses that gun in defense of herself and her child. The guy is found to have on his person zip ties and a walkie-talkie, which kind of tells me this guy was in communication with somebody else, and this guy wasn't necessarily interested in the stuff
right.
that was inside that home. He was interested in the people who were inside that home.
So often, more often than not anyway, sex assault is about power and control. It's not about sex as so many people want you to believe, especially when it's being touted by a political campaign. You know, I have honestly been told, well, you survived without a gun. What's the big deal? You know,
wow.
You use different methods to get away, and they don't use a gun. And statistically, that could have been turned around on you anyway. The biggest problem here is that those comments start. They start with victim blaming. It's on me somehow to think of ways to get away without turning to, like, literally the greatest equalizer of our time. Statistically, men are bigger than women. What's the best way to physically equalize myself against an attacker? A firearm. I'm not going to take my chances with a rape whistle. Or, you know, I actually tried saying that, hey, I made up a lie. I said I have an STD. I have to go to the bathroom. I'm claustrophobic. I tried all of these things. They did not thwart that attack. But, I mean, furthermore, what no one cares to hear is that while I might have been my attacker's first victim that we could at least identify, at the time of his arrest, it was just 3 weeks later, he was picked up at an apartment complex not half a mile from mine. He was taking pictures of other college women that were sunbathing around the pool. He's choosing his next victim. So, yes, I survived. But at what point does this man's growing number of victims and escalating behavior stop? This guy had zip ties in his back pocket and all of these things. But, you know, we're not going to hear more than one or two media cycles because it doesn't fit the mainstream media narrative.
Right.
But he had to start somewhere. And I'm guessing he started at the same point as my rapist did. It's breaking in. It's stealing underwear. It's seeing how far you can get. How far can you push until you just start escalating and escalating? And, yes, this woman did a fantastic job of protecting herself and her kids, and that story is not going to get the attention that it so deserves. But the Cosmo articles definitely will.
That's the thing. I don't even know if this story out of Indianapolis, I don't think it got national attention. I think I saw it in one other, like, local TV station that wasn't in the Indianapolis area. I had picked up the story, but you're right. And, you know, the Cosmo story is going to get that attention. Here's the thing, though. You know, I think, as you say, I don't think Cosmo is serving its audience, because I'm guessing, Kimberly, that there are some Cosmo readers out there who are also gun owners.
Or at least there were.
Or, yeah, okay.
Well,
point,
you know,
point taken.
So this is going to sound terrible. I was scrolling through their Twitter feed looking for that original post about the gun control conversation.
Yeah.
Let me give you a little brief taste of what these guys also peddle to their readers. Are you ready for this? What it's like to fall in love with your brother. Real headline. Are you sexually attracted to the wax version of Justin Bieber? And why drink normal beer when you can drink vagina beer? Excuse me, that is in no way, shape, or form the people that I want telling me about how best to protect myself. I literally feel my face melting from the stupidity.
Suffering from a lack of credibility is what you're saying.
I think that's exactly what this
is. Yeah. Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, Frank Minniter of Forbes, Dennis Santiago of Dennis Talks Guns, joining us next hour. Right now, you can find her on Twitter, Lady Liberty 1215. Katie Moyer joins us, talking about the Pennsylvania primary. How you doing, Katie?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I am fantastic. It's good having you on the program today. So, a busy day in presidential primary politics in Pennsylvania. You're seeing Bill Clinton, seeing Donald Trump in the same 24-hour period, right?
I am. Yep. I saw Bill Clinton. He spoke in Harrisburg this morning around 12:30. That was quite the treat.
Oh, I can imagine. What kind of crowd was there for the former president?
He had a really big crowd. I would say there were maybe 600, 700 people there, very diverse and super energized and excited about him. And there was also a lot of different ages there. I was expecting to see more just older people based on the kinds of things that I've heard in the media, but there were a lot of younger people there too.
Do you think it was because they're Hillary Clinton fans, or it was just the chance to see a former president?
I think that a couple schools let people out for the day to go see the event, honestly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so. But I also, I think a lot of people just, like, regardless of political, like, policies or anything like that, I would just wanted to go and see the former president speak. So I think that was, you know, right downtown in Harrisburg, right near our state capitol. I think a lot of people just wanted to come and hear the former president.
Interesting. And where is Donald Trump speaking tonight?
He's speaking at the Farm Show Complex. So that holds, I think they're expecting, like, huge crowds.
Is he going to be in the large arena there?
I believe so. They said they're expecting up to like 10,000 people to show up in Harrisburg tonight for it. So I would assume it's going to be in the whatever is the biggest place within the complex.
Okay, yeah, I think that would be the large arena. That's where the NRA Country Concert was held during the Great American Outdoor Show, and it does hold about 10,000 people. So
nice.
So there you go, 600 to 700 people for the former president, about 10,000 people expected for Donald Trump. Are the airwaves inundated right now with political commercials in Pennsylvania? Are all the campaigns spending money on TV and radio ads?
Oh, yeah. You almost can't not hear them. they're on every commercial break, on TV, on radio. We're really getting hammered here.
And is it who are you hearing from? Are you hearing from all of the candidates that are left in the race? Are you hearing those spots?
So I haven't heard anything from... Oh, I'm sorry. Are you still there?
Yep, we're here.
I'm so sorry. So I haven't heard anything from Bernie Sanders in terms of commercials, but I have heard a lot of Kasich. Kasich was the first one that was out. And then after that would be Donald Trump has come out with one, Ted Cruz, and I've heard a couple Hillary, mostly Republican. I think the race is pretty tied up in terms of the Democrats. I think they think that Clinton's going to win Pennsylvania.
Interesting. All right. So you've got a piece at Penn Live today. I get it, America. You're angry.
Yeah.
And you know, yeah, that's easy to pick up on these days. But you say, you know, what happens after that? And I've always said this. I think that anger is actually the least effective emotion.
Yeah.
Because when you're angry, you're typically not at your best. You're not doing your best work. You might mm-hmm. be passionate, but you know, if you're filled with rage, you can also, I don't think you're at your best. So at some point, you know, let's say the rage subsides. And then you ask, and by the way, you say the anger is justified, right?
Yeah. I think that there has been, tons of examples of failure, whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, a conservative, a liberal, whatever. I think that there are a lot of things that we can point out that are real, true problems that are going on. But I think that we need to look at what those problems are. And when we look at them, I think that the biggest issue is too much government involved in any issue, whether, you know, Bernie Sanders, people say it's crumbling infrastructure. It's the rigged political system. You know, just there are so many examples that you could use that the problem is government being involved too much.
I need to give you a copy of our friend Laura Carno's new book, Government Ruins Nearly Everything. I think that you would like that very much. All right, well, I'll make sure you get a copy of that, Katie, because I think you all are on the same page there. You know, you say let's get back to our limited government roots where we aren't relying on the government to take care of us and ensure equal outcomes.
Right.
You know, I think I'm right there with you, Katie. But the problem is, I think that, you know, there is a competing point of view now that is very popular, particularly among, let's say, Sanders supporters of no, Katie, you're wrong, because we need the government to protect us. We need the government to protect us from rapacious big business. We need the government to protect us from, student loan companies who would take advantage of us and, you know, mortgage company. We need the government. We need the ever watching eye of Uncle Sam, which kind of looks like the eye of Sauron, but don't get too caught up on it. We need that ever watching eye of Uncle Sam to look out for us. Otherwise, we're lost. We'll be wiped out.
I think that it's an interesting argument, but I think it also, when we look, I think we need to look at history. We need to understand what our country was founded on and why we are so prosperous and unique as Americans in the way that we rely on ourselves. We wanted a very limited government so that we could have the freedom to choose to do things. And I think that even in the past 50 years, we look at all the government programs that have been put into place, like the war on poverty, the war on drugs. A lot of these programs where the government has been trying to make big government programs to, all hail the government, they're going to fix this problem. Well, they're not fixing it. And, we just can't keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. So maybe the problem is that the government is incompetent. I mean, we need government. Don't get me wrong. I'm not an anarchist. I think that we need government for things. But I think that we need to stop relying on the government to solve all of our problems, because it's not solving our problems. So one of the examples that I like to talk about is, a lot of people from the LGBT community, they want the government to be more involved with LGBT issues, in particular, like in the gay marriage issue. They wanted them to be more involved in it to give them their freedom, but they're not understanding that the reason that they don't have those rights or that they're being held back is because the government is involved in marriage to begin with, or just that the government is involved in things that I don't personally think it should be involved in. It's just causing more problems than helping.
You know, I think for a lot of folks, and I'm sad that we've gotten to this point, but I think for a lot of Americans, the constitutionality and the role of the Constitution and how, the various forms of government fit into the Constitution, I think that matters less to a lot of them than simple, is it working or not?
I agree.
And I don't think that, like I said, I don't think it's a good thing, but I think it is a thing. Unfortunately, I guess unfortunately and fortunately, you don't have to just make the constitutional case. You can also make the effectiveness case, right? And you can say, look, things are getting worse, if not better, in a lot of areas. We're going to be talking a lot about what's going on in some public schools later on in the show. And it's fascinating to me, Katie, that, here is an area, you've got St. Paul, Minnesota, where you've got a huge gang problems right now. And you've got teachers in the public schools who are complaining that kids are getting into fights, they're selling drugs in class, and nobody's getting disciplined. Right. I mean, here is the government at work. And this is one of supposedly this is one of the core functions of the government, is to educate its people. And they are falling down on the job. You've got teachers and students who are terrified to go to school because there's absolutely no punishment for students who are, I say disrupting the classroom environment. They're fighting. They're dealing drugs. I mean, they're breaking the law and there's no repercussions there.
That's a shame. I would challenge, I've been racking my brain since I wrote that op-ed to think of something that the government does really efficiently. And I haven't figured anything out yet. I just think that government isn't the solution. And you're totally right when you're saying that you don't think that the Constitution really matters to people. And I think that's really sad, because our rights do not come from the government. We don't need to be asking permission from the government for these things. That's where we've got it backwards, is our rights come from God. We're born with these rights, and we don't need to be asking the government to be doing all these things. We need to be individuals and look to be more self-sufficient than just relying on the state.
Absolutely. Listen, Katie, unfortunately, we've got to run, but I appreciate you coming on the program. Have fun tonight.
Thank you.
And folks can follow you again on Twitter, Lady Liberty 1215. You'll be tweeting from the events.
Of course.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Bye.
Katie Moyer joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. And again, I don't think this is a good thing, but I do see this happening more and more, where the reaction to, hey, here's what the Constitution says. The reaction is, so what? Who cares? And that's a problem in its own right. And it is another failure, I think, of education or government, civic institutions. I'm sure there's a lot of blame that can be passed around. But a failure to inculcate in a generation, perhaps two, some very basic civics lessons. Not just about what our laws are and what our framework of laws happens to be, but why it is what it is. Why does the U.S. Constitution look so different than the, let's say, the 1935 Joseph Stalin Soviet Union Constitution? And more importantly, why does the U.S. Constitution and that Constitution from the USSR in 1935, why do they have some similarities? Why do they both talk about freedom and liberty and the rights of individuals when in one country those rights existed, not just on paper, but in reality, and in the other country, trying to exercise those rights would make sure that you ended up in the gulag for 10 years, if not in a mass grave somewhere. We're not teaching these very basic principles. And again, you don't need a master's in public science to understand these things. You just have to be taught. You have to be exposed to these things. All right, stick around. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Noslers. Coming up next, we're going to talk about a constitutional crisis. My colleague Jenny Simone with us after a break. Frank Miniter from Forbes, Dennis Santiago as well. We've got a busy 60 minutes ahead, so stick around. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Jonathan Rockett with the Shooting Club. Jonathan, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Great. I'm fantastic. Good to be here.
Well, you got a cool product. We were talking a little bit the other day, and I had to grab you guys over to talk about it. Tell me what is, and tell everyone else, what is the Shooting Club?
The Shooting Club is the world's first smartphone app that connects shooters across the country in competition for cash and prizes while promoting gun safety. We found that accidents happen with guns because people aren't proficient with them. They sit in a drawer. They don't know how to use them. Maybe you've been to a shooting range once or twice, but if you're rusty, it doesn't really matter. So we found that if we can find a way to reward people and make it fun and give away money, then people will take it a little bit more seriously. So we have a proprietary handicapping system which allows shooters who are very new beginners all the way up to retired cops and military to compete against one another on a fair playing field.
Dude, what a great concept. So, all right, so I got a lot of questions for you here. Before we go to how does it work, how did it go from this, hey, I got this great idea, to something that you're just getting ready to launch now in the App Store?
The whole idea started two Thanksgivings ago. My dad and I were talking. I was visiting him out in Houston, Texas, and he had commented he just got a new handgun, and his brother, who lives in Louisiana, had gotten one also. And they were trash-talking a little bit about who's a better shot. And he said, wouldn't it be cool if there was a website where we could upload pictures of our targets and see who was a better shot? My regular business and my background is in web development and design, and I said, you know what, that's a really good idea. We looked and we looked, and there was nothing like that out there, so we decided to build it ourselves. Two years later, here we are.
Wow, that is so cool. All right, so it's called the Shooting Club. How does it work?
So you download the free app from the iPhone store or from the Google Play store.
Got it.
And you find a local range using GPS on your phone if you've never been to a range. At the local range, you purchase one of our official competition targets. You scan the QR code, and then you take the target, which is very, very unique and fun, which is really the secret sauce of what we do. It's really four targets in one. You shoot it according to the rules. You use the app itself, which uses your native camera to take a picture, scores it, handicaps you, and uploads it into your activity feed so all your friends and followers and fellow gun lovers can see your scores.
That is so awesome. What a great idea.
You can even form private groups that are just for maybe a couple of buddies that are for your own private competitions as well.
And I'll tell you what, Jonathan, we're always talking about here on NRA News how important it is to keep the shooting sports and hunting and everything related to that, the Second Amendment, everything related, keep it vibrant, keep it growing, keep it relevant. And what a great way to do this, to actually be able to merge, because the biggest thing is, people get so caught up in technology, they actually don't go out and shoot anymore. But this merges technology with going out and shooting.
And it makes it social. We found that if you have a buddy that lives in another state and you both love to shoot, but you never have a chance to go together to a range and make it a social activity, now we've removed the geographic and the time borders to do
that.
As you follow people, you can post your stuff to Facebook. You can form your own private groups, upload pictures. Hey, I just got a brand new 9mm. I can't wait to try it out, etc. And what we found is... is this is bringing in some of the growing interest groups, such as women and millennials, who are newer to shooting sports, and it gives them a platform to really take it and run with it.
Before we run out of time, how do we get more information about the Shooting
Club? You can go to theshootingclub.com or look for the app, The Shooting Club, in your app store.
Jonathan Rocket, The Shooting Club, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News.
You bet. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Frank Miniter of Forbes, Dennis Santiago from Dennis Talks Guns, going to join us on the program. Coming up here in just a minute, we're going to share with you a clip and talk with my colleague Jenny Simone, her latest, A Constitutional Crisis. I want to give you a little bit more detail about the 14-year-old down in Winter Haven, Florida. Ryan Raish, who works for ABC Action News down there in Lakeland, Florida, has been reporting on this story. He was able to let me know that this 14-year-old has 9 felony convictions to his name, 13 arrests, 13 different mugshots, starting at age 11 when this young man stole a car. Again, now 14 years old, he is wanted. He is considered armed and dangerous after shooting into an occupied dwelling. And a lot of questions are now being asked, and sadly will probably only be asked during this particular news cycle, about how a 14-year-old can get 9 felony convictions and be on the streets when the juvenile justice system is supposed to keep a close eye on individuals, particularly individuals who are not just at risk but are risking others in the community. And they're supposed to be engaged in intensive efforts to turn these young individuals around. What kind of efforts actually went into trying to not just rehabilitate but turn this 14-year-old from the life of crime that he was on. We're going to continue following the story. But right now, I want to talk about another story. My colleague Jenny Simone just out with her latest piece, A Constitutional Crisis, talking about the nomination of Merrick Garland by President Barack Obama to the U.S. Supreme Court. Jenny Simone sat down and talked with former Attorney General Ed Meese about this. Take a look at a special clip here from Jenny Simone's special report, A Constitutional Crisis.
Today I am nominating Chief Judge Merrick Brian Garland to join the Supreme Court.
Probably no president in modern history has trashed the Constitution by executive actions as this president. And so to allow Obama in his last year in office to put another judge on the court, in other words, to pack the court with people who don't believe in the Constitution and who would not follow the Constitution, I think would be wrong for the Constitution and wrong for the country. Both of his previous nominees swore to uphold the Constitution and said they would when they were confirmed. They did that before the Senate committee.
The task of a judge is not to make law. It is to apply the law. Fidelity to the law.
And yet, as soon as they took the bench, they fell right into this block of justices who vote against the Constitution, particularly decisions on matters like the Second Amendment, the ability of people to own and bear arms. This is typical, I think, of a mindset that Obama's nominees have, including the current nominee, and that is that the Constitution ought to mean what the judges say it is rather than what the Constitution actually says.
So what I hear you saying is that an Obama nominee is no Justice Scalia.
That's correct. And I don't think Obama would ever nominate someone who really followed the Constitution as Justice Scalia did. And that, of course, could mean a major change in the laws of the land. To allow this idea of anti-constitutionalism to be perpetuated for a quarter of a century or more to come with the confirmation of a nominee made by this president, it's a threat to carrying out the vision of the founders, and therefore that I think the Senate is very properly saying, let's let the people decide who the next president will be, and that's plenty of time then to put someone on the court. I think that the election of 2016 is probably one of the most important elections, certainly in my lifetime, in terms of the interpretation of the Constitution, because of the divided court that we're facing at the present time.
Hillary Clinton becomes president. What would life look like in this country?
If Hillary Clinton was elected, we would simply be having Obama's third term, because she has been lockstep with him in terms of our national security, in terms of our economy, in terms of the rights of citizens being protected. And I think it would be a real tragedy for this nation if that happened.
What do you say to those people who say, you know what, I'm thinking about sitting out this election?
When we have a constitutional crisis, I think anyone who sits out the election really is failing in their duty as a citizen to vote for a president who will preserve the constitutional republic that the founders gave us and protect the Constitution, which has made America different from any other country in the world.
And right now, my colleague Jenny Simone joins us on the program to talk about her special report a little more. Jenny, how you doing today?
Pretty good.
I appreciate you coming on the program. I mean, Ed Meese, talk about a legal legend. To be able to sit down and talk with him about the importance, not just of that seat on the Supreme Court, but ultimately the importance of the 2016 election. I mean, what was that like?
Oh, I mean, the man is amazing. And, you know, you walk in his office, Cam, and his wall is just a picture, a mural of his lifetime. And, you know, he actually advised President Reagan when Reagan appointed Justice Scalia to the high court. And he really does understand what's going on here and what's at stake. And, you know, we talked about the fact that Heller and McDonald decisions, they really are at risk of being overturned, you know, if this happens. Because right now, our rights hang in the balance in the court. There's no longer a majority of support for Heller and McDonald among the justices, and he was very clear about that. And his group put out a memo, the Conservation Action Project, about supporting the Senate's decision, basically saying it's the people who should have this voice in determining what happens with the court. So, you know, come November, you know, a lot of people just go in there and they think they're pulling a lever for the president, but there's a lot more riding on that when you pull it.
Absolutely. You know, we're talking again about, as you say, you know, fundamentally perhaps changing the direction of the court for decades to come, and, you know, putting in place a majority. That's the thing, Jenny. I mean, this isn't a hypothetical. We've read the dissents in the Heller case and in the McDonald case. We know that there are justices right now on the Supreme Court who say that the court got it wrong in Heller and McDonald, that they need to revisit it, and that they really need to rewrite that individual right to keep and bear arms out of our Constitution, out of our Bill of Rights.
Justice Ginsburg herself has said that. So where are we, you know? And it really was amazing, though, talking to him about Scalia, because Meese really knew Scalia. And, you know, I was fortunate enough myself to meet Justice Scalia in Nuremberg when I was there covering the story. And, you know, he was just everything you expected and more. He was so colorful. He was funny. He was outspoken. And he believed in the right. He, too, himself was a hunter, but it was more than just that he loved to hunt. It was all about the right and the constitutional amendment, and that's what he stood for. And, you know, you look at the court and you wonder, is that going to dissolve? Is that are we going to, like you said, are we going to be rewriting the Second Amendment? Is it going to be taken off the books? I mean, it's a scary thought. What could happen?
It absolutely is. All right, so folks can hear more of your interview with Ed Meese at NRA News. Just go to the Jenny Simone reporting section of the website. And, Jenny, I'm really looking forward to having you back on again talking about your latest special report.
You know, and, Cam, you were talking about that 14-year-old. And the thing that's so disturbing is you were talking about, you know, the system supposed to monitor him and all that. And in the meantime, this person's on the run, whether he's 14 or he's 24 or he's 34. And we got to live in fear.
Absolutely.
And they want to take our right away to protect ourselves. It's just bizarre. The system is upside down.
It is, but we'll keep trying to right the ship, so to speak. Jenny, thanks so much for your time today.
You got it. And we got a big event coming up in Louisville where we are going to be riding that ship.
Yes, we do. Less than a month from now, actually, May 19th through the 22nd. And hopefully I'll get a chance to actually see you before then. But if not, we'll see you in Louisville.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Jenny.
All righty. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
Always. Jenny Simone joining us, my colleague here at NRA News. And again, you can head to, well, you're here, hopefully, maybe. Might be listening on SiriusXM or iHeartRadio. But you can head to NRAnews.com. Again, just go to the Jenny Simone reporting section of the website, and you can watch the entire interview with former Attorney General Ed Meese. Frank Minter of Forbes coming up a little bit later on in the hour. We were talking last hour, mentioned Harriet Tubman. on the new 20 because Salon Magazine says the right is freaking out about this. And I haven't seen that. But you know what you can find? You can find a piece from someone on the left, Feminista Jones. Tubman wouldn't want to be on the $20 bill. Mm-hmm. From the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, saying that Harriet Tubman would not have wanted the honor. It was because it's capitalism. See, it's all about, well, the Tubmans now, I guess, not the Benjamins. You can find that argument again from the left, people who are unhappy about Harriet Tubman being on the $20 bill come 2030. But you won't see Salon writing about that. Now, I did mention last hour when we were talking about St. Paul, and we also chatted with Katie Moyer about what's going on there. You know, again, it's not just that we are seeing this increase in violence where a third suspected gang member has been charged in a death in a St. Paul park. You are also seeing, again, this violence in the St. Paul schools, where teachers feel like there is no justice, where there's no disciplinary process, where crimes are being committed in class and in the hallways, and the system is sort of shrugging. There was a story out of Wilmington, Delaware today, a horrible story. A high school sophomore beaten to death by her class members. By several of her class members there in Wilmington. This was Wilmington, Delaware. High school sophomore. Apparently a fight started in a bathroom there at Howard High. And apparently it was over a boy, according to authorities. But then a group, apparently, of students joined in this attack. Delaware Online says detectives from the Homicide and Violent Crimes Unit are interviewing multiple students who are considered persons of interest in the assault. Two female students taken to police headquarters for further questioning. Police said that they do not believe that anybody outside of the school was involved. Officers called at about 8:18 in the morning to the high school. High school principal Stanley Spohr said the assault of the 10th grader from Newcastle occurred in the women's bathroom as classes were starting. She was flown by state police helicopter to DuPont Hospital for Children in critical condition, was later pronounced dead from her injuries. There was a press conference earlier today. Police Chief Bobby Cummings would not comment on rumors circulating about what happened in the bathroom, according to Delaware Online. Said there were no incidents that he knew of in the preceding days leading to the assault. And he said that Howard is not known as a violent school. Nathaniel Kenyatta, a freshman there at Howard High, lost his friend. He said she was very open. I feel bad for the people who have known her for years. Delaware Online says community members are at a loss for what could have prompted this community tragedy. Beverly Bell is a Eastside community activist there in Wilmington. She said she feels for the parents who are now scared for their own children. She said schools have to be a safe place with hall monitors and administrators ready to take action in situations like Thursday's assault. She said we've got to have people in place to watch over our children. Because when a parent sends a child to school, it's not to get a phone call that their child won't be coming home. Now, the superintendent there of Wilmington, Delaware, Victoria Gert, said the death of the sophomore at Howard High does not reflect negatively on safety in the school. You know, you can say something. You can't make people believe it. Wilmington mayoral candidate Kevin Kelly said that the incident is not reflective of Howard's safety. He said, quote, but it is a reality check of some of the things that go on in Wilmington.
Well, again, what does that mean? So, yeah, these fights happen. City Councilman Namandi Chigwocha agreed, saying fights among women are not uncommon, especially in these cities' youth. He said, some of the worst fights I've seen in the community have been with the females. We need to address the needs of the young women. As of right now, I don't think we're doing that. According to data from the State Department of Education, last year there were 7 violent felonies reported at the high school, 14 incidents of fighting and disorderly conduct. Over the past 5 years, 127 incidents of fighting and disorderly conduct. 10 violent felonies over the past 5 years there at the school, but 7 of them, again, came last year. Which should also be some cause for concern. Because I think the most that you had before then was 2. And now all of a sudden, then that last year, you've got 7 violent felonies reported at the school. All right, we're going to take a quick time out. When we come back to the program, and again, tell me in Wilmington, Delaware, that the answer here is another gun control law. When you've got city council members, when you've got mayors, when you've got superintendents, no, don't worry about the safety. Stuff like this does happen here. Well, I've seen some really brutal fights. Hillary Clinton says it's never about the individual. It's never about the person. It's always about, it's not ever, you know, it's also not ever about the knife or the fist or anything else except for the gun. For Hillary Clinton, it always comes back to we have too many guns, too many gun owners. Maybe we have too many gun manufacturers. But it's never about the individuals. It's never about the real flesh and blood human beings who are engaging in these violent acts. In some cases, again, time and time and time again, in some cases, maybe their first offense is an incredibly violent offense like this. But it's never about the individuals. It's always about the gun laws for Hillary Clinton. All right, when we come back, Frank Minniter of Forbes joining us, talking about a couple of columns that he has actually at Forbes, including what might be coming here in the lawsuit filed against the manufacturer of the rifle used by the murderer in Sandy Hook Elementary School. Dennis Santiago of Dennis Talks Guns later in the hour as well. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News Cam and Company right after this.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed and Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh, so glad to hear.
Tell us, what is Armed and Heels all about?
So Armed and Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed and Heels to support the working woman, the empowered women, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried. You were terrified. Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried. And then he put it away. And
I see.
It
okay.
maybe took 2 years to get the guts
really?
To do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No, no way.
No. So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. You seem to have it figured out. This, I love your approach. I love your idea. Great. So how can people get more information about Armed & Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed & Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed & Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
I want a woman president. But I want an honest president more. I want someone who can place their hand on a Bible and swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution without telling a lie. Someone who believes in the integrity of that office. A president whose actions reinforce the moral lessons I teach my children. There are many powerful, accomplished women in both parties who meet and exceed that standard. But you, Mrs. Clinton, are not one of them. Your past is littered with shameful, dishonest behavior, decades of decisions that point toward your own power and fortune, not the best interest of women, the country, or the truth. There is no greater threat to my freedom than another dishonest president. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I know you're watching, so pay attention. You hate my freedom, my religion, and my country. You hate me for speaking my mind. You try to control me with violence and intimidation. You think you can muzzle me with fear? Don't ever confuse me for my politicians or my media. I am an American, free-born and free-bred, and I will call you out for who you are. An Islamic extremist who would kill me for my beliefs. You don't intimidate me. My freedom is more powerful than anything you can possibly do. And I will never, never surrender my rights to your terror. I will say what I think, worship according to my beliefs, and raise my children how I see fit. And I defend it all with the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. I cower to no one, because I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
It's your first source for Second Amendment news and information, and like probably 90% of talk radio, tributes to Prince and our bumper music today. Frank Miniter of Forbes is with us on the program right now. Frank, how you doing, sir?
Hey, Cam. Good to be here, as always.
It's good to talk with you as well. You got a couple of columns, actually, at Forbes that I want to talk with you about, including this one dealing with the lawsuit filed by some of the family members who lost loved ones there in Newtown, Connecticut. A judge last week ruled that the case can go forward. She didn't say anything about the merits of the case, and there will be other opportunities for this case to be dismissed, but the case can proceed, at least for now. And so you say that this might lead to sort of a fishing expedition among the plaintiffs looking for all kinds of stuff within the corporate files, so to speak.
Oh, that's exactly right. This is now going into discovery. I mean, the attorneys on the defendant's side have stalled until June 20th when there's a hearing on throwing this case out again. But again, it'll be before the same judge, and she's already called for discovery. So it's very likely that this is going to go into discovery. That means the attorneys get to sit down and depose the firearms executives at Remington and at the gun store and the distributor, ask them whatever they want to ask them. I remember interviewing some of the executives who were interviewed and deposed the last time these cases, before this was made, these frivolous lawsuits were made illegal by Congress. I remember I interviewed a bunch of those executives who got deposed, and they were asked everything. I mean, it was a complete fishing expedition, going through their files, but also asking personal questions, asking what they own, how they market firearms, and everything you could possibly imagine to try to find wrongdoing or something they can bring out to the public in a certain way that insinuates some kind of wrongdoing. So yeah, I do think it's a fishing expedition.
You know, you will see a lot of legal analysts say that they still think that the legal reasoning here is weak and that the case is likely to be dismissed. The judge says, well, the argument that the plaintiffs are using doesn't fall under the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which is why the case can proceed right now. But they are, in essence, arguing that the AR-15, whether it's this particular firearm or AR-15s in general, should not have been marketed and should not have been sold to, what, anybody beyond the military and law enforcement, right? Should never have been available for civilians.
Right. They're saying that the people who made this, the Bushmaster, owned by Remington Arms, should have known these shouldn't be made available to the public. When of course, Colt first started selling the AR-15 to the public in 1963, which was just before the military first procured the AR-15, which then became the M-60 in the full automatic version. So these have been available to the public right from the beginning, and there are millions of people who now across America own this type of rifle. It's the most popular type of rifle selling today. So to argue that the companies who somehow know that this very legal product, that has been a legal product for more than a half century, should be illegal, it should be thrown out on its grounds, I would imagine. But I don't honestly know what this judge is thinking. By bringing this to this place with this case, is she trying to harm firearms manufacturers before the case can be thrown out? I mean, I just don't know.
I don't know either, Frank, and we'll probably never know, or maybe it'll be a long time before we learn the answer to that. But, it is interesting because Hillary Clinton has talked a lot on the campaign stump. She's in Connecticut right now, actually, and she's talking about what Connecticut did legislatively in response to the murders at Sandy Hook Elementary and calling it a role model for the rest of the nation. She's also talked again about how suits, you should be able to sue gun manufacturers, not just in this case, but you should be able to hold them, sue them, seeking to hold them accountable for the third-party actions of criminals. And one of the things that I've been wondering here is just, you know, how consistent Hillary Clinton would be. You know as well as I do, Frank, right now violent crime is at, what, 40-year lows in this country, mm-hmm. right, and close to all-time lows. Drug overdoses are at all-time highs. And that includes prescription-based opioid medications. So would Hillary Clinton, who's taken millions of dollars from pharmaceutical companies, would she endorse the idea that we should be able to sue these drug manufacturers seeking to hold them responsible for the third-party actions of drug dealers and those who are leading this rise in drug overdose deaths?
Yeah, well, she is for. I mean, she's on the record for repealing the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. So she would make it okay. And it was the previous Clinton administration that started these lawsuits trying to hold firearms manufacturers accountable for the actions of criminals. So, yeah, I think she would love to go back to that time. What it really was, if you look at it, and this has been said a lot, was an effort to actually bankrupt firearms manufacturers, which it was doing a pretty good job at for a while. It was costing them a lot of money to play defense against these frivolous lawsuits. I think Clinton would love to bring that back.
Even for the drug companies that she's taken millions of dollars from, or do you think that she'd find some sort of legal loophole there?
You know, that's a strange place for her. I think she's this is a journalist speaking, this is what I see, but I think she's a politician of convenience, and I think she will, when it suits her needs, do a different thing than she's doing now. I think she's telling people what they want to hear, right? I think that's part of the reason people love Bernie Sanders, is he actually seems to believe what he says, where she doesn't.
Yeah, although it's interesting. I think that the 2016 Hillary is probably closer to what Hillary truly believes compared to, let's say, the 2008 Hillary, who was portraying Barack Obama as a way, way anti-gun. And she was a supporter of the Second Amendment. And, you know, she grew up learning how to shoot, and she talked about to her grandpa taking her duck hunting. She said in 2008, Frank, that, look, what works in Manhattan might not work in Montana and vice versa. So we don't need these big federal laws. I think what we're seeing from Hillary this year is actually much closer to how Hillary Clinton really truly believes.
I wouldn't be surprised, but again, I think that makes her the chameleon I think she is. She'll change as she needs to, as she changed when she ran for senator in New York, for the Senate race here, and here I'm in New York. She changed a lot of her views to meet the certain populace, and I think she'd do it again.
I suspect that you are correct. Now, speaking of changes, we're going to get a new $20 bill here in over a decade, Frank, and you write about this at Forbes. The new $20 bill is making gun rights advocates and conservatives cheer, which is funny because I just saw this headline at Salon earlier today talking about how conservatives hate this. Now, I haven't seen any evidence of that,
But but why are gun rights advocates and conservatives cheering about Harriet Tubman being on the new $20 bill?
Well, she was not only a Republican. Of course, that's, you know, this is the party of Lincoln, the party of anti-slavery. She was not only a Republican. You know, she's a former slave who helped slaves on the Underground Railroad run out of Maryland and get out of the South during the time of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
But she was also a gun owner who carried a gun to keep herself safe as she was transporting people and getting people out. And then during the Revolutionary War, so the Civil War, she joined the Union forces and actually carried a rifle and did some pretty heroic things during that war. So she believed in standing up and holding her Second Amendment proud to fight for her freedom. So, you know, that's why gun rights people like her and conservatives should like her.
Absolutely. You talk about how you can make a movie out of her life. I was talking about this yesterday with, I think it was Sonny Bunch of the Washington Free Beacon Online, that I think it would actually be better. You could probably do like a one or two season, you know, Netflix or Amazon Prime series, because you could, you know, she made, I think, 19 separate trips to the South as a conductor on the Underground Railroad. That's I'm guessing, Frank, you could probably find 19 compelling episodes of television just right there before you even get into her exploits during the Civil War and her own fight for freedom.
She also guided boats through a minefield to help Union forces get in. And then when they actually, this is in South Carolina, when they went in and freed slaves from plantations, the slaves came running back to these boats, and she witnessed the whole thing. She was a part of that whole thing. So she literally freed slaves. Just an absolute hero.
That's amazing. And as you point out in your column at Forbes, her pistol and her saber are actually on display at Florida A&M University, right?
Absolutely. And that's pretty cool.
That is,
you know,
pretty cool.
I wish they were in the Smithsonian or the NRA Museum. But it's just fantastic that those are out there for people to see, because that part of freedom is just so pivotal. And I think especially today, as you see certain people that are disenfranchised here without their rights and their liberties, to look back to her and what she did is just so inspirational.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I appreciate you writing and giving folks a history lesson, considering that the number one question apparently on Google yesterday was, who is Harriet Tubman? I'm glad that you could provide an answer for folks.
Anytime, Cam.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Frank Miniter, at Frank Miniter on Forbes, frankminiter.com is the website. Dennis Santiago from Dennis Talks Guns will be joining us on the program here in just a little bit. So we were talking about Los Angeles and the fact that an increase in aggravated assaults in L.A. last year, responsible for more than half of the nationwide increase in violent crime. But L.A. is not the only city, unfortunately, that has seen a spike in crime either in 2015 or in 2016. In Las Vegas, they are also seeing a spike in violent crimes this year. And the Las Vegas Review-Journal says that there are sort of these disputes about what's actually causing this. A California gang expert disputing claims by top police officials there in the valley that this is caused by an influx of gang members from Southern California. Wes McBride, who is the executive director of the California Gang Investigators Association and is a retired gang detective, so the problem is actually the decision by Las Vegas police to decentralize its gang enforcement unit. Oh. Now, the Las Vegas Valley right now is seeing a violent crime wave, according to the newspaper, with marked increases in rapes, robberies, assaults, and homicides. Las Vegas police had recorded a 20% increase in sexual assaults over the same period compared to last year. Robberies and aggravated assaults are up 25% and 24%, respectively, from same time period last year. In 2015, the Metro Las Vegas Police Department recorded 136 homicides. And compared to where we were in April of 2015, the homicide rate is up 91% over the same time period. Now, again, not as high as we have seen in the past, but also going in the wrong direction here. So what is it? Is it that you've got more gang members coming in from Southern California?
Or is it that the tactics in responding to the gangs, whether they are based there in Las Vegas or coming in from outside of the area, and I would imagine, by the way, that the Las Vegas, being Las Vegas, you are probably going to get some gang activity from outside of the metro area. What's going on here? Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo, Under Sheriff Kevin McMahill, have both publicly said that the recent spike in crime likely a result of California gang members coming into the valley. McMahill said that gang members from Oakland are, quote, trying to come in and take over some of the local drug trade. We have friction between a variety of gangs, which has led to some of the shootings that we have. Police have also offered up some bits of evidence, apparently. 13% increase in the number of field interview cards, which document police interactions with gang members involving people from Southern California in 2015. This year, there was another 13% increase. Las Vegas Police Lieutenant Laz Chavez says a lot of these gang members seem to think that Las Vegas is just a suburb of Los Angeles, where, again, violent crime was skyrocketing, particularly aggravated assaults last year. He says he knows of at least 13 incidents this year in Las Vegas that involve gang members from Southern California, including a high-profile double homicide off the Strip in February. Metro Captain John McGrath from the Metro's Organized Crime Unit says that there are local gang members also contributing to the problem. The department has documented about 15,000 gang members in the valley. And they say the department is trying to address the issue by decentralizing multiple investigative teams, including the narcotics and gang enforcement units, and by implementing the sheriff's, quote, violent crime initiative, which puts detectives back on patrol through the summer. But the gang expert says if you cut back on these specialty units here, then you're going to see an increase in violent crime. We've heard the same criticism actually offered in Chicago. This was one of the things that Gary McCarthy did before he was fired, and there's been no plan that I've seen to restore these specialized gang units. Mayor Rahm Emanuel has called them cowboy units and doesn't like them. So the idea in Chicago, and it looks like the idea in Las Vegas, was let's disband these special units and just put those officers, you know, back in the regular rotation. We'll have a beefier street presence in high-crime areas. But what you lose is the information-gathering ability, because you don't have the same relationship with informants, particularly. If you don't have those specialized gang units, you don't have officers that can develop their sources the same way that you do when you have those specialized gang units. If you're just a beat cop, hopefully you're going to be able to, you know, come across folks in the neighborhood that you can chat with and talk to. But it's not always going to be the easiest thing if you're in a uniformed marked car there. So the gang expert says that all of these substations there throughout the Las Vegas Valley now have to, they're sort of on their own. There's no central clearinghouse to share the information that does get gathered. He also says that the Metro Police Department has a motive to attribute the crime increase to Californians. He says if they admit to having a local gang problem, then they are seen as being a weak administrator. Sounds like, honestly, in Las Vegas, you could be seeing a mixture of both. You could be seeing an influx of gang activity from California into Las Vegas. But again, you also have some 15,000 gang members. Again, going based on the FBI assertion that in you know, some metro communities, you've got, what, 80% of the violent crime in a community committed by 20% of the gang population. So you're talking about with a gang population of 15,000 people, what, maybe 2,500 people in the Las Vegas area with more than a million residents and how many countless tourists you have every year. You are probably looking at, again, around 2,500 individuals responsible for a preponderance of the violent crime plaguing that community. The struggle is actually focusing on those 2,500, actually getting all of the law enforcement resources on the same page, and actually getting politicians to understand that that is where the real problem lies, as opposed to, let's say, the few, There are a lot of you out there in California who would like to be able to exercise your right to keep and bear arms. The relatively few number of Californians who can do so in an unfettered way, that's where they want to put the focus, on the legal law-abiding gun owners, not on the people committing crimes. And it doesn't matter if it's Los Angeles or Las Vegas or Las Cruces, frankly. That seems to be the way right now. There is a better way out there. All right, Dennis Santiago of Dennis Talks Guns talking about California. Actually, when we come back, some anti-gun laws aimed in the wrong direction, passing out of the Senate Judiciary Committee in Sacramento. And we'll also talk about armed crime deterrence in metropolitan areas. Dennis says we need to make the patchwork more transparent. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News Cam and Company right after this.
I'm speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. Gentlemen, welcome to NRA News.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Tell me, what is AmericanSnipers.org all about?
We're a nonprofit, totally volunteer. Nobody makes any money. But basically what we do is we raise money, we buy gear, and we send it to military snipers overseas to do the business that needs to be done.
And how did you start this?
In 2002-2003, we're basically police snipers from around the country. There's a big, I guess, the community's very tight, but there's a wide spread of us. And a couple of us were being deployed as reservists and National Guard as snipers. They were also police snipers, and they needed gear that they didn't have available. So we put that together, started this little project, raised a little bit of money, and then realized there was a big need. And that was 2003. We've since grown legs, and here we are 14 years later, still raising money, sending gear to snipers in country.
So, Ron, going from where you guys started in 2003 to now, what's the trip been like? How has it grown? What's happened?
Well, it's been quite an adventure for us, but a lot of the needs have not really changed. The sniper units only have so much money, so once that money runs out, the guys are doing without. So we're still providing things, mostly sniper-specific gear, like rangefinders, spotting scopes, rifle scopes, gun cleaning gear, binoculars, that kind of thing. And it's the type of gear, like Dave said, when guys are getting deployed, they would call back home and they're asking mom and dad, hey, can you pick me up a wind meter? Well, folks don't generally know where to get that kind of stuff, but we do. So that's why they come to us, and we're able to get them their specific gear that they need.
Speak with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. All right, so you guys start this. It's a no-brainer to me. It's a great idea and a great service you're all doing. What's the reaction rolling this out in the sniper community?
We have, when people know what we're doing, all they want to do is help. And where they can help us is we raise money. We sell swag. We sell coins and little trinkets. People give and donate. The manufacturers will donate, but for the most part, people hear about it and they go, that's awesome. I'm upset we have to do that, but yeah, we want to help them.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, David. Ron, what do you guys think about, and I don't want to get political, but what do you think about that? It's got to be frustrating to officers to know that sometimes they can't get the support they need to get the equipment that they need.
I don't think that's ever going to change. I think as long as we have a bureaucracy that has budgets and budgets get tight, we're not going to always be able to get the things we need. We know that as police officers. We know that as the military, there's priorities. And the bottom line is, as American citizens, we're going to support our military. And when people recognize that and we can broad stroke share that, they want to be part of that.
That's cool. Once again, speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org, you know, there's a lot of folks who don't understand what it is, the mindset, the mentality, the life of a sniper, whether it's a military or police. Ron, what can you tell people about, how can they understand best what you guys are, what you go through, you know, help get inside your head?
Well, it's just a very specialized thing that we do. It's something that people volunteer for, but you also have to have the right mindset and the determination and the professionalism to go through that. It's not for everybody, and not everybody gets to do it, but it's a very special thing, and guys who earn that spot, we try and help them out by doing what we do.
All right, it's a big sacrifice. Military police, you're sacrificing.
Right. So give us an idea of some of the people that you've helped and who have benefited from AmericanSnipers.org.
Without naming names, it's been hundreds of guys in all different branches of the service. So we're at events like this. We get approached by people and said, hey, in 2004, you sent us a bunch of gear. You really helped us out. We hear from parents. So that's what we get out of it. That's what we find fulfilling.
Gentlemen, I bet you that never gets old either, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. And then some of the gear that we get or we get donated, we get to give that back to the manufacturers. We had a company that donated some knives.
Tell folks how they get more information about AmericanSnipers.org.
Well, you can go to our website at www.AmericanSnipers.org, and that's where they can donate. We always have gun raffles going on constantly of some pretty high-end guns that we get donated to us.
David, Ron, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being part of NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome back to the 1980s. Paul Bedard of the Washington Examiner on the program next hour. Right now, at Dennis Santiago on Twitter, Mr. Dennis Santiago from Dennis Talks Guns. How you doing, Dennis?
How you doing, Cam?
You know, I am okay. I appreciate you coming on the program. I'm glad I live in Virginia, I suppose, as compared to California, because I'll be honest with you, Dennis. I kind of thought you all already had all of the gun control laws on the books that the anti-gunners could dream up, but no, apparently they are back at it again. The Senate Judiciary Committee in Sacramento approving a whole host of anti-gun measures yesterday.
Oh, yeah, and amazingly enough, most of them were already vetoed by the governor at least once, if not twice.
That doesn't matter. And honestly, that doesn't matter to the anti-gun activists. They will try again. What are some of the bills that we're talking about here?
Well, let's see. There's one having to do with they want to remove a provision on bullet buttons. So they're basically saying now, no, you can't. You got to register those, which is kind of a strange one because what that actually does is it activates a 90-day re-registration clause in existing law that allows anybody with a bullet button gun that can only take a 10-round magazine to register them as what they call statutory assault rifles, at which point they can take the bullet button out, put the magazine catch back in, and insert anything they want.
It's weird.
This place is madness. There's a reason I greet you with welcome from, you know, greetings from behind enemy lines I talk to you.
And this is, I think, let's focus on this for a second because this is a fascinating look at how anti-gun activists work. So you go back to what the early 1990s, right? When you had the quote unquote assault weapon ban.
1989.
And then the bullet button provision. This was written in such a way that you couldn't have just the external magazine a button, right? So this complies. You can't access this button with your finger or your fingernail. You have to use a tool, maybe a small screwdriver or the tip of a bullet, to actually press that magazine release button and to get the magazine to actually release, right?
That's correct.
And the reason why this was done was to make it harder and slower for people to reload under the anti-gun theory that this would make people safer.
Actually, the bullet button came about because they wrote the original law basically saying that any future semi-automatic rifle that met certain design characteristics could not have a detachable magazine. And that's where the must use a tool to remove it came from.
Okay.
Well, innovation.
But that was the idea, right? Was to make it harder and slower to reload.
Or impossible. Essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time that the way you reloaded an AR-15 in California with a compliant gun was you popped the hinge, opened it up, and inserted stuff into the unhinged receiver and then closed it, and that's how you reloaded them.
Wow.
It was weird.
Yeah. Okay, so this is how we got to where we are today, and now the anti-gun activists say, well, this is still, again, it's too easy, right? So we want to go back and again make it as difficult and as possible for people to reload their firearms. So they want to get rid of or say that any of these firearms that have the bullet buttons could no longer be produced in California.
Well, the actual objective is that when this stuff was originally done, was what they wanted to do is they wanted to fix the number of owners of semi-automatic rifles in the state and make it so that no additional owners could come about, and that over a period of time, these owners who could not transfer their rifles to anyone else would grow old and die, at which point there would be no one eligible to get one of these at all in California. So what they were shooting for from the very outset, and this goes all the way back to 1989, was the total extinction of the ownership of this class of firearm in the state of California. That was the goal.
Now, has that happened, Dennis? Have they been able to eradicate interest in ownership of these firearms? Because I got to tell you, around the country, I think they're the most commonly owned and sold rifle these days. So,
well, oh my God, no, no. I mean, the exact opposite has happened. Because of those California laws, what was at a time, back in 1989, the people that owned these types of rifles, it was an obscure kind of specialty collector type of thing. It was used primarily by competition shooters, and it was kind of left by the wayside. You know, people bought different kinds of guns. They concentrated on handguns, and that's where all the battle was going on in the late 80s was over handgun control. Well, they didn't succeed at that, and so what they thought they would do is they would try to figure out how to do a ban. And essentially they said, let's go after something that's small and obscure that nobody cares about. And they said, well, there's a class of rifle that nobody cares about because there's not very many of them around. So they start this fight. The effect has been that it's become so popular that it was actually worth it to the manufacturing industry in the United States that makes AR-15s to come up with a way to get them back into the single largest and most lucrative firearms market in the entire nation, the state of California.
Talking again with Dennis Santiago of Dennis Talks Guns. All right, so that's a quick look at some of what passed out there in Sacramento, and we'll be talking more about this on the program. But before we run out of time, I also got to ask you about your latest column here at Dennis Talks Guns, Armed Crime Deterrence in Metropolitan America. And you say this is not an article about the Second Amendment. It's not an article about gun control. This is, as you say, at the core of the animus-laden political debate about guns is how they affect crime deterrence in metropolitan America, right? This is ultimately, and again, I think it's sad that we've got a lot of Americans who don't really care about the Constitution. You can say, listen, we can talk about your rights. Nah, they don't really care about their rights. They want to talk about the effectiveness, whether things work or not, right?
Yeah,
and so,
exactly.
And so let's talk about whether or not the ability to protect yourself with a firearm actually serves as a deterrent, and B, whether or not these restrictive gun control policies are a deterrent against crime or a deterrent against gun ownership. Because, you know, there in Los Angeles, I learned yesterday, Dennis, that Los Angeles saw an increase in aggravated assaults so high last year that it was actually responsible for half of the nationwide increase in violent crime in America's 30 largest cities. Just one category of crime in Los Angeles.
Yes. And it's all because of something called realignment, which was, for some strange reason, the state of California didn't build enough prisons, and so the prison space got overcrowded. There was a federal judgment that said you had to go do something about it. So what did we do over here? We started letting them go.
Yeah, you did. You let them out early, and then you moved some folks from the state prisons down to the county jails, which meant that there were less county jail spaces for people who...
Yeah, and then they had to let them out early.
Yeah. There's a spillover effect.
Yeah, I mean, the concept was, no, we'll let them out, and then we'll monitor them in the streets while they're on parole. And the rest of us are going, oh, my God.
And we see how well that is working out here.
Not so much, yeah.
Right. But what about the idea of actual armed crime deterrence, as you write about Dennis Talks Guns?
Well, see, that's what I decided to write about, and actually I built a computer model. I'm in the middle of finishing it up on its first pass. That actually takes all the stuff that I mentioned in the article about the different kinds of resources that are available. So I start with the police. Then from the police, I go to security forces, security guards, that type of stuff. Then I go to homeowners. Then I go to shopkeepers. Then I go to CCWs. And I try to basically say, look, these are all resources that are available in communities. And if you are a police chief, if you're a sheriff, if you're a mayor, if you're a city council person, if you're a state assemblyman or whatever else, you really need to be looking at all of these resources, and you need to be looking at it objectively. And you, and by looking at it objectively, that's when you're going to be able to tell a lobbyist to go take a hike and leave you alone to actually get the job of public safety done properly.
You know, I would encourage folks to go to DennisTalksGuns.blogspot.com, read your piece. We're also we've got it tweeted out at Cam and Company as well, because you know, look, you get beyond the hype, you get beyond the bumper sticker sloganeering, Dennis, and I think you do get to what is important here, and that is the public safety of these communities and across the country. Look, there are too many bad neighborhoods full of good people that have dealt with this for too long, and they've heard so many empty promises from politicians that it's going to be the next round of gun control laws that'll start to fix things, right? When in reality, as you point out, you've got a very small group, a very small portion of the population that is responsible for these violent crimes, treating the entire community as if they are all just criminals waiting to happen. So we've got to erect this barrier between them and their rights. That doesn't help anybody except for, frankly, the violent criminals.
At this point, it helps two groups. It helps violent criminals because it gives them a free pass to do more. And it helps people that are proponents of big government because it argues that, well, we're the only people that can do stuff. Well, the fact of the matter is if you take the time to look at all the resources that are available in the community, that is a completely wrong position to take.
Absolutely. Dennis, hey, listen, I got to stop you there. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we'll talk again very soon, okay?
Sounds good, my friend. It's always good to talk. You
all
take
right.
care.
Thanks, sir. You too. Dennis Santiago joins us. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, right after this. Michael Graham is with us from News Radio 106.7 in Atlanta, Georgia, the star of the Michael Graham Show.
I'm also the podcast director for the Weekly Standard Magazine. You guys know, I mean, we're in the new media world, whether you're listening on streaming or you're listening on iHeartRadio or on SiriusXM or on Roku. Mm-hmm. You got to get your NRA news.
You do have to.
And it's so important. The content is so valuable. Even Cam can't screw it up. And that's it's really, when you think about it, that, wow. I mean, I should have started doing this Second Amendment stuff way on, because this... I tank everything I do, so it's easy. And what's so funny, too, is I love the fact that I've become a semi-regular kind of guy.
Yeah.
Because even though I grew up with guns, I've had a gun. In fact, I wrote a piece in the Dadley Virtues series of books. Mm-hmm. They did the Dadley Virtues, and then they did the
Christmas Virtues.
That was the third.
The Seven Deadly Virtues.
The Seven Deadly Virtues. And anyway, so the third one was Christmas, and mine was about the year when I was 9 years old and I got a shotgun for Christmas. So I've had a shotgun, a little 20 gauge my whole life, had pistols my whole life, but I was so bad at firing them that I rarely, you know, they would take me hunting and my job was to not get killed. That was like, just don't, if we came back and I had no shot to pick out of me, I had done it right. And yet here I am defending the Second Amendment rights of competent people like you who know what you're doing with firearms. I don't. If the fate of civilization rests on me being the last guy with a Glock, we're done.
Well, see, this is the cool thing about this show is that we get to talk with people like you who support the
incompetent
right.
Incompetent idiots, yes.
Yeah, incompetent idiots. Yes, no, yes. People who support the right, but, like, I mean, you'll admit, like, you're not a marksman, right?
No,
but
we
run the spectrum because there is a spectrum. Not every gun owner in this country has to be Julie Golub, has to be captain of Team Smith & Wesson. You know, not everybody needs to be Kim Rohde, five-time Olympic gold medalist or Olympic medalist. There are people who will get to the range, you know, once every 6 months. There are people who own a firearm, excuse me, because they want to protect themselves, but they're not marksmen. They're not going to win Top Shot, right? But I know people who aren't even gun owners. They don't own a firearm, but they support the Second Amendment. They are NRA members.
In fact, I think I represent a huge number of people who are thrilled when we have neighbors in our community or we have members at our church or coworkers who are serious Second Amendment people who take their gun ownership very seriously and practice. I love that because it's essentially a, you know, a peace militia in my community. It's good guys with guns. And so I love it. So once again, if you've seen me shoot,
well, you're benefiting,
you'll tell me to put the gun down, but I'll cheer you on. It's the same thing with the military. I do work with a great charity, Fisher House Foundation. It's kind of like Ronald McDonald House.
Awesome charity.
And by the way, unlike the Wounded Warrior dirtbags, they don't blow their money on big salaries and pay celebrities. So Fisher House Foundation, it's like 90-something percent goes to the cost.
I donate to them yearly.
Yeah, they're great.
They're awesome.
But
So I
do a lot of vet stuff. When I'm with vets, they start talking. And they say, well, what about your experience? Dude, I have no experience. When I was in high school, I took the aptitude military test.
Right.
Yes. And my guidance counselor said, Michael, you are utterly unfit for a military service of any kind. And so she suggested I join the Navy. And I tell that I get my dad's a sailor. My dad was a sailor. He was in the Navy, so I get to tell that joke. So I'm over in Iraq broadcasting from Baghdad right when things were at their worst and to hang with these military guys. And I just kept telling, I can only be the cheerleader. That's it. And they're like, oh, no, you'd make a great. So after like 5 minutes of me, they go, you know what? Just stay away from everything. I get my thumb stuck in grenade things. And
but, you know, I have the same sort of attitude because I never served in the military.
Right.
First one of my, you know, family not to, I think, going back to, we missed Vietnam, but every other war since then. And I didn't join the military. But I have, because I didn't join the military, I understand the obligation and the responsibility that I have to support those who did. Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by Nosler starts right now. Paul Bedard of the Washington Examiner talking about Hillary Clinton doubling down on her anti-gun push in Connecticut. Kurt Schlichter, the author of Conservative Insurgency and way too many columns to mention my name. He joins us later on in the hour. Right now, let's get to our deal of the day, our good guy of the day, and our hero of the day, sponsored by Adcore Defense. We'll start with our hero of the day. Comes from Times Call. This is Erie News Now. I got my heroes and my deals confused. Erie News Now with your hero of the day. Two good Samaritans, they say, credited with helping two homeowners and a Cleveland woman after hearing cries for help inside of a home along Crescent Drive in Erie, Pennsylvania, Tuesday morning. Erie Police Chief Don Dacus says 25-year-old Kyle Johnson entered this home Tuesday morning and had beaten the homeowner and a woman inside the residence. Johnson was actually wanted by the Oakwood Village police for abducting a 23-year-old woman the night before, Brandy Shakir. Shakir was in the basement of the home at the time that the beatings took place. The Good Samaritans apparently heard the struggle outside of the home, and they entered the home to find a woman badly beaten and her husband restraining Kyle Johnson. So these two Good Samaritans, strangers, called 911. They tried to hold Johnson down, but when police arrived, Johnson got away. That's when one of the men pulled out his gun and shot Johnson twice. He still took off. Erie police officers followed Johnson towards the Erie Yacht Club before apprehending him. Now, the 23-year-old who was apparently kidnapped was taken to hospital to be treated for her injuries. The woman who was beaten by Kyle Johnson, allegedly by Kyle Johnson, is in critical condition. Her husband's injuries not serious. And the Erie Deputy Police Chief, Don Dacus, says that no charges will be filed against that Good Samaritan for shooting Kyle Johnson, who was booked at the Erie Police Department, then transported to the Erie County Prison. So it sounds like he wasn't seriously injured. His bond currently set at $500,000 cash right now. And thankfully, again, those two Good Samaritans coming to the aid of individuals inside their home. I confess, this is not an armed citizen story that we usually see. We've seen stories of Good Samaritans coming to the aid of people in a restaurant, out in public. But not often you see a story like this where strangers come to the aid of another They're in their own home. But thankfully, those two Good Samaritans were out there in Erie, Pennsylvania, and they are our hero of the day. Now, our deal of the day. From the Times Call newspaper, Longmont, Colorado, a convicted murderer who was arrested in Longmont last year on charges that he pulled a knife on a woman was arrested again on Monday of this week after police say he went to the same woman's house and refused to leave. 55-year-old Roy Gene Seagraves Jr. now faces stalking, burglary, intimidating a witness, and violation of a protective order, as well as a bond condition charges in connection with the Monday night incident. Seagraves apparently acquainted with the woman. He was arrested on burglary, attempted robbery, burglary, menacing, and stalking charges after he reportedly came to the woman's home and threatened her with a knife about a year ago, March of 2015. The woman told police that Seagraves had come to the home multiple times and had threatened her if she didn't give him small amounts of money. Seagraves eventually pleaded guilty in Boulder District Court last year to felony trespass and in violation of a protective order. He was sentenced to 347 days in jail, as well as 3 years of unsupervised probation. This was not Mr. Seagraves' first run-in with the law. The Times Call says that he pleaded guilty in 2001 to second-degree murder in connection with the 1982 death of Gary Stoner, who was stabbed 63 times in the head, neck, and back. Investigators used DNA evidence to link Seagraves to the crime. And so he pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in 2001. 6 years later, in 2007, he was out. 6 years after pleading guilty to second-degree murder, he was out. And in 2007, police arrested him on assault charges after they say he stabbed a man over a stolen children's bicycle. But the charges were later dropped after Seagraves agreed to plead guilty to a drug charge. So you've got a guy who did apparently less than 7 years for murder. He gets out. A short time later, he stabs someone in an argument over a bicycle. And what does the criminal justice system do? Hey, you know what? We'll dismiss the violent crime if you plead guilty to the drug charge. And so he did. 2013, Seagraves was arrested on attempted murder and assault charges after Boulder police say he held scissors to a man's throat, but the charges were later dropped at the request of the Boulder County DA's office. So maybe there were issues with eyewitnesses. Oh, don't know. But the prosecutor's office decided not to pursue charges. Police say that Seagraves is a member of the 211 crew, a white supremacist prison gang. One of its members, Evan Ebel, killed Colorado prison chief Tom Clements and pizza delivery driver Nathan Leone in 2013. Ebel was killed during a shootout with Texas authorities. Seagraves remained in custody on Wednesday. He's due in court on Thursday. That'll be today. Roy Gene Seagraves Jr. now facing again stalking, burglary, intimidating a witness, violation of a protective order, and bond condition charges. Based on past history, one has to assume that all of the violent charges will be thrown out and Mr. Seagraves will be allowed to plead guilty to violating the terms of his bond conditions. But let's hope that's not the case. All right, our good guy of the day. From Tucson, Arizona. This really is a cool story. Actually, I'm sorry. This is not. This was picked up by Tucson, but this is actually from originally reported by KMOV in Wentzville, Missouri. It was a Tuesday afternoon. A 2-year-old child woke up from her nap. Parents did not know. And she walked outside, and she ended up blocks away from her home. Now, she's two. She can't tell you how to get back. But the family cockapoo was by her side, reports KMOV. And Sarah Woodard on Tuesday afternoon. She was at the bus stop, and she said, we saw a police officer holding a little girl and a utility worker holding a dog. The little girl and her dog were found wandering down a busy stretch of Duello Road there in Winsville, Missouri. So Sarah Woodard and neighbors started knocking on doors. The little girl, according to Woodard, said she just kept saying, Mom, she wanted Mommy. That was it. We're all trying to rack our brains on how to get this girl home. KMOV says with no luck from the neighbors' efforts, an officer looked to the dog and got an idea. With the help of animal control, they scanned the dog's microchip, which led them to the child's house in the Bluffs of Heather Glenn edition. Chief Kurt Fritz of the Winsville Police says it was thinking out of the box for the officers. He says that his officers were able to get the toddler home safely. The girl had been gone for about 30 minutes or so. When they arrived, the parents still had no idea that their daughter had woken up from her nap and had left the house. So you can imagine their reaction. The chief, by the way, says, quote, the house was childproof. There was one sliding door that was not. And I'll tell you, it doesn't take much for a child to slip away quickly. It's an unfortunate incident that turned out okay. So to that quick-thinking officer there in Winsville, Missouri, don't know who the officer actually is, but a tip of the cap for being one of the good guys out there. And I've got to say, the story really resonated with me because when I was two, I wandered outside of my backyard. We had just moved to Oklahoma City, and I think it was within like a month or so of us moving. And I left. Apparently my mom was making lunch. I was in the backyard. I undid the latch on the fence and I started wandering away with my dog who we had just gotten a couple of weeks earlier. And so my dog was a puppy as well. So apparently I don't have no recollection of this. This has just been told to me time and time again. Apparently I was found, in the middle of Southwest 89th Street, which is was a 4-lane street at the time. I was walking down the median strip, with my little dog and a car driven by a couple of very nice ladies stopped me and scooped me up and actually followed my dog back home. That's how I got back home. So I'm very partial to these stories where dogs are able to help a wandering two-year-old return safely home. So a big tip of the cap to the officer there in Winsville, Missouri. And if those ladies are still alive, thanks for saving my life way back then. All right. Still to come on the program, Paul Bedard of the Washington Examiner, Kurt Schlichter joining us as well. We've been so busy with guests today. Tomorrow on the program, I want to spend some time. There are two pieces that are out today that I think are worth exploring. One by Emily Zanotti over at Heat Street, Sidewalk Chalk, the New Campus Contraband. And the other piece, I'm still having a hard time wrapping my head around saying these words, but the other piece that is worth reading is that it's at Vox. Fine, I'll just say it. It's like ripping off a Band-Aid. It's at Vox. It's on smugness in American liberalism. There is a smug style in American liberalism. Write someone on the left, by the way, talking about the lack of empathy. We talk a lot on this program about the betters versus the bumpkins mentality. Yeah, that's what this article at Vox is pretty much all about. And it's interesting to me that it goes so well with what we are seeing here on the college campuses where you don't need to engage in a debate. All you need to do is say you're not allowed to have that opinion. I don't have to talk with you because what you say upsets me. It triggers me. So therefore, I'm going to leave. And by the way, you're wrong. I'm going to report you for microaggressions and things of that nature. There is the writer of this Vox piece talks about the knowing that comes along with the smug attitude, right, of you already know everything that there is to know. You know that more guns equals more crime. You know that the problem with violent crime in this country are law-abiding gun owners, or it's the gun lobby, or it's fire manufacturers. You know that owning a gun, and he actually talks about this in the Vox piece, owning a gun makes you a jillion times more likely to have it used against you in your home. You know all of these things, even if you don't really know them. you've read them somewhere. You know this is the correct way to think, and so there are a lot of folks who don't. It's not only that they can't do the math, they can't show how they got to their opinion. They don't really even know what their opinion is. They know what they're supposed to believe, and they know the talking points, but there is no real substance beneath those talking points. They don't give it a lot of thought. They don't have to, because again, they can rest smugly in the false knowledge that they already know everything. Again, I thought it was interesting that Vox actually specifically brought up the gun debate at one point of this. Vox author brought up the gun debate at one point in this subject. And given how the fights over free speech and the free expression of ideas and, frankly, believing what you want to believe, how these are playing out both on campus, in the broader culture at large, and on any variety of issues, including your right to keep and bear arms. We're going to spend some time tomorrow talking about that. But Paul Bedard of the Washington Examiner joins us after a quick timeout. Hillary Clinton is in Connecticut. She is keeping up her anti-gun arguments. We'll talk about it with Paul right after this here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Welcome on set, our friend Melissa Bachman, the host of Deadly Passion on Sportsman Channel. Melissa, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I wish I could be there in person, but unfortunately the winter weather is not cooperating with us. So tell me, what's going on in your world? What are you working on in 2016?
Well, right now I just got started on Season 5, and I'm really excited about this season. We've been on the air for quite a while now, Season 5, but one thing that I actually brought that's brand new that I've been trying to brainstorm for several years is a new segment called Memory Chase, and that's all about trying to get more kids involved. And the reason I did it is I wanted viewers at home to have a chance to send in their kids' footage. I remember when I was little, I used to look through our Outdoor News newspaper and look for photos of other kids, and then always want to submit mine. So it's kind of the same idea. So what I'm doing is about a minute and a half segment for those kids who get picked, and then their footage can be on TV. They get a huge prize pack, just a really good way to get more kids involved.
Oh, that's really, really cool. And again, I mean, reaching back to your own childhood, we know that, look, we know that bringing kids into the world of the outdoors is critical. And it's not just critical for the industry. It's critical for the next generation. You know, I as a father of five, I want my kids to understand that there is a world beyond the TV screen and their tablet. You know, I want them to get out and enjoy the great outdoors. And unless we actually help them, you know, I don't think they're going to do that. The TV's right there. The tablet's right there. It's so much easier to just stay on the couch, but it's so much better to actually get outside.
Absolutely. And what I'm trying to do is really bridge that gap. You do have so many kids on YouTube. You've got them online. You've got them watching the television shows. So use that medium to get them outside. So that's kind of been the idea behind it. I also know we don't have to give kids prizes for everything, but it doesn't hurt either. So a new bow, all sorts of great stuff. Plus they get to see themselves on TV. We've had a lot of submissions since it started. The first five were amazing. It's just really neat for anybody to see that real reaction from the kids, and it makes, you know, other adults excited and kind of reminds us to do our part as well to get out there and to bring kids along.
You know the threat is real. You sit in meetings with advisors and operatives who tell you there could be Islamic sleeper cells in every major American community. You know the southern border is a welcome mat for terrorists to enter our towns and neighborhoods at will. You know about their plots to kill us in our shopping malls, our sports stadiums, and our office buildings. You won your office by talking like a champion of freedom. Now it's time to act like one. Pass a national right to carry law that guarantees my constitutional right to defend myself, my family, and my fellow Americans anywhere inside our borders. And make sure the enemies of freedom know the power of freedom. No law-abiding American should be forced to face evil with empty hands. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician.
A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up, but I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Mr. Kurt Schlichter joining us on the program in just a little bit. But right now I want to welcome from the Washington Examiner. You can find him on Twitter at Secrets Bedard. Mr. Paul Bedard with us. Paul, how you doing, sir?
Hey, boss. How are the goats?
They're doing pretty well right now. We don't have any in the house. That's a good thing. So, and if you need any goat's milk, let me know, because seriously, I'm overwhelmed a little bit right now with goat's milk. So. Now, you've written a piece talking about Hillary Clinton. You've been following how the gun issue has been playing out here, primarily in the Democratic primary for months. It is not new to see Hillary Clinton touting her anti-gun credentials, but, she really stepped it up in New York. And now with the primary shifting to Connecticut, she is obviously talking a lot about gun control. She is teaming up and partnering with some of the family members who lost loved ones there in Newtown, Connecticut. And this is perhaps her big pitch, the primary focus of her Connecticut campaign, it seems, right now.
Exactly. It seems as if the only issue she's running on in Connecticut, and it makes sense because of Sandy Hook, is bashing the NRA, taking on guns in some fashion. You know, leading into her, she was in Connecticut today. She was in Hartford. She appeared with the daughter of the principal who was at Sandy Hook. That daughter has also appeared in a new ad for Hillary Clinton. It's a touching kind of moving ad in which the daughter says, "Hillary reminds me of my mother." So it really kind of plays at the heartstrings. You know, in Philly yesterday, kind of coming into Connecticut, she expanded her attack not just on, too many guns in the streets, but she said now there are too many guns in the homes. And that kind of links up with her earlier claim that too many people have guns. So, she's not targeting those who are misusing. She's targeting all of us.
Yeah, this is interesting. This was, I think, a new line from Hillary Clinton. You know, one of the lines that we had heard in New York was that guns from Vermont were committing crimes in New York. And she didn't want to talk about the individuals who were committing violent crimes in New York, but she talked about Vermont guns committing crimes. This new focus on we have too many guns, as she said, in this country. Now, she didn't get specific, Paul, right? She didn't say, like, here's what the correct number of guns would be, and here's how we go from, 400 million firearms to X. But because she doesn't want to, I think, really talk specific, she wants to try to demonstrate that this is an issue that she cares deeply about.
Well, it's code language, and I think we all understand what it is. She doesn't want us to have any guns. So it doesn't matter if you're a hunter and you have, a bunch of different calibers, so five, six rifles, or if you're a target shooter and you have 50 guns. It doesn't matter to her, I think. And that's kind of the scarier language that she's come out with this week, where she's talking about guns in your home, the number of people who have guns. You know, I talked to Grover Norquist, who's on the NRA board, and he said, listen, this goes right to whether or not you can defend yourself in your home. If you need, those who might have a collection or placed around their house, now is she going to come in and say you can only have one? It kind of raises anew the concern about her policies.
It does. And, you know, you can go back, I guess it was, it might have been earlier this year, maybe it was late last fall, but she was at a fundraiser, and I think this was in New York State, and she talked about how the Supreme Court, in her opinion, got that case wrong, referring either to the Heller case or the McDonald case.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you believe that the Supreme Court got one of those or both of those cases wrong, that there is no individual, what you say in essence is that I don't think there is an individual right to keep and bear arms. And Paul, you know, the Second Amendment doesn't mean that you can have a gun in your home for self-defense. And it certainly doesn't mean that, Cam, you can carry a firearm for self-defense out in public. You know, you're right. And we have to kind of get beyond the weasel words of the politician and actually try to, you know, burrow down to what would this actually look like in terms of policies being put in place.
And even, Kim, if there are policies, you know she can't get it through the House, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is another case where you have to look at, okay, she's president of the United States. It doesn't matter. She can appoint the next Supreme Court justice. So there are many ways for her to you know, push these policies through once she's elected. And I think that's why you have so many folks who are now starting to wake up to, oh, my gosh.
I think so. Because, you know, it's interesting. Hillary, as I said, has been part of her campaign from the get-go. I think in New Hampshire,
yeah.
I think I saw you report this. In New Hampshire, 1 in 4 of her campaign ads focused on gun control. And periodically, you know, through the early states, this would come up. Yet we've seen, you know, look, Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin. She lost Wyoming. She lost, I think, what, 8 straight primary and caucus contests.
That's right.
So this is not an issue that apparently resonates all over the country. Does it resonate in Midtown Manhattan? Yeah. Does it resonate in Connecticut? Maybe so. But does this resonate across the all 50 states, Paul?
No, of course it doesn't, but it resonates in urban areas and suburban areas. So once she's in the general election, if you look at Ohio, for example, and she gets the bulk of votes from Cincinnati, Cleveland, Columbus, those areas, then she can win that state. And people are aware of this issue. Is she going to win West Virginia, Florida, places like that? No, they're going to turn her down over this issue. But it's a winning issue for her.
In the Democratic primary, right?
In the Democratic primary, but also in the general election. Now, you know, there's going to be, let's say, you know, I live in Virginia. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a pretty big pushback, but you know, we're at a stage now where there are vast, bigger numbers of urban voters. So, for example, in Virginia, does Northern Virginia, Richmond, and Norfolk overwhelm the rest of the state? That's what she's betting on.
Interesting. And, you know, in that sense, I think part of the discussion, and I imagine it's not a discussion that many folks in the media and certainly a lot of campaign surrogates for Clinton won't want to talk about, but that's the effectiveness of these laws. You know, she was in Connecticut today. She called the laws that were passed in 2013 role models for the rest of the country. And yet you look at what has happened in Hartford, Connecticut, since the passage of those gun laws, and homicides have gone up, Paul, not down.
Well, that gets to maybe, I guess, her eventual goal, which is just eliminate guns.
Yeah. Do you think we're going to hear hear anything close to that?
No.
Between now and November.
Even I'm not that nuts, but yeah. I don't think that'll happen. I mean, she's not even talking about her $1,000 tax. She's not talking about some of the things that her husband put in place. So she's wary of the issue, but, you know, her people know what she's saying. And that's why it's important, I think, for those on the other side to also read into that code language.
Absolutely. Paul, listen, I really appreciate you coming on the program. It was good talking with you. We've got to do this more often.
Hey, I'd love to. Thanks.
Absolutely. And make sure you check out Paul's columns at thewashingtonexaminer.com. And be sure to follow him on Twitter as well. Like I said, he is covering not just this issue within politics, but he is certainly one of the few reporters out there who is really paying attention to how the Second Amendment is impacting the political campaigns on a regular basis at Secrets Bedard there on the Twitters. Kurt Schlichter going to join us in just a little bit talking about some of the big news of the day. We will, of course, be asking Kurt what he thinks about the passing of Prince. But Hillary Clinton, again, as I said, she's in – this is from ABC7 in New York City – saying that the quote, bipartisan gun control legislation passed in Connecticut after the murders in Newtown, Connecticut, should be a model for the nation. Should be a model for the nation. And homicides have gone up in Hartford since the passage of those laws. Just like in 2013, the state of Maryland passed the Maryland Firearms Safety Act. And Martin O'Malley, who, by the way, was trying to run as the anti-gun candidate there in the Democratic primary until he dropped out for lack of interest, he said that those laws, very similar to Connecticut's, were going to make Maryland safe. And what did we see last year? Homicides skyrocketing in Baltimore, Maryland. Baltimore, Chicago, Washington, D.C., all home to really restrictive gun control laws, all with huge increases in homicide. In fact, those three cities alone account for about half of the increase in homicide in the top 30 cities in the United States. Just like we see on the campus carry issue, professors and students who write and opine about their objections to campus carry, and they never talk about Colorado, Utah, states that have had campus carry in place for a number of years. They don't want to talk about what happens when you actually put these policies in place. Anti-gun politicians really don't want to talk about what happens when they get their way, or rather what doesn't happen when they get their way. Because they promise all kinds of safety. They promise, oh, this is going to make things so much better. And they don't. Because the people who are committing these violent crimes, the vast majority of them, they're not legal law-abiding gun owners. And that's where these laws are aimed. These laws, you know, at the same time that Maryland passed its law, Connecticut passed its law, New York passed the SAFE Act. Again, supposed to make New York safe, right? Because it's the SAFE Act and all. And what has been the primary result of the SAFE Act? So the 7-round magazine limit, that was eventually reluctantly dropped by Governor Cuomo when people pointed out to him, they don't make a lot of 7-round magazines, Governor. That didn't matter to the governor at first, by the way, but eventually it did. The registration of semi-automatic rifles, not a lot of New Yorkers have apparently gone along with that. The background checks for every ammunition purchase that were part of the New York SAFE Act, they've not gone into effect. The unlicensed possession of a unloaded firearm has gone from a misdemeanor to a felony. And that's been the primary increase in charges there, is simple possession of a firearm, not an increase in charges for violent offenses or anything like that. Nope, we're just charging people with a felony, something that used to be a misdemeanor. And by the way, something that in many states across the country is not even a crime because they don't have local gun licenses. That's been the chief effect. But they don't want to talk about that. Because then they have to talk about why it is that the Maryland Firearms Safety Act and why it is that these new gun laws in Connecticut aren't making a difference in Hartford. And they're not making a difference in Baltimore. And they're not making a difference in Chicago. And the ordinances in Los Angeles passed last year aren't making a difference in the violent crime rate in Los Angeles. And they don't want to talk about what has happened. They want to talk about what can happen. In the case of campus carry, they want to talk about the bad things that can happen if we pass campus carry. In the case of gun control, they want to talk about the wonderful things that can happen if we just pass these gun control laws. But if they are unwilling to talk about what has happened, it should give you some pause. It should make you think. And hopefully it is. For some people. All right, we're going to step away for a moment or two. When we return here, Kurt Schlichter will join us. We've got more from Hillary Clinton in Connecticut, apparently, who says today we need a national movement. By the way, going back to the 60s and really starting in the early 1970s with the National Council to Ban Handguns, you've had a national anti-gun movement. And it's gone by different names. It's had different benefactors over the decades, but you've had one. What's fascinating is since the early 1970s, since the advent, really, of the big anti-gun movement, Americans' attitudes towards things like whether or not handguns should be illegal have moved strongly in support of the right to keep and bear arms. But we'll talk about this a little bit more with Mr. Kurt Schlichter. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV. Jana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So I follow you on social media, and I always see, you know, you're out. Geez, you're everywhere. So I'm glad you had a chance to sit down and talk to us for a minute. But you use Nosler ammunition, and Nosler is our primary underwriting sponsor for NRA News Cam and Company. So I've been dying to get to sit down with you to talk a little bit about that. So tell us, how did you form this relationship with Nosler using their stuff?
Absolutely. Well, Jim Kinsey, my boyfriend and executive producer of Skullbound TV, he had a relationship with Nosler, a previous relationship. He introduced me. I'm from the Midwest, from Wisconsin.
I couldn't tell by the accent.
I know.
You betcha.
You betcha. He introduced me to Nosler about 6 years ago, and that is literally the only ammunition I have used. For all six seasons of Skullbound TV, we're filming right now for season six, and it's just so incredibly accurate and dependable. I did a really neat episode this year. You know, Nosler was founded on one of their moose hunts gone bad years ago, the ammunition, not on Nosler ammunition, but,
right.
You know, they founded the ammunition company because they needed something more reliable after this bad encounter with a moose hunt. And I ended up drawing an incredible moose tag, went into Alaska, do it yourself, rented the horses, packed in, ended up just being blessed with a 64-inch bull moose.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, those Nosler bullets did the trick.
And I'll tell you what, Janet, whether you're shooting, hunting like you do, shooting competitively, this is probably, if not outside the firearm, the most important thing to be a successful shooter.
It really is. I mean, a lot of things can go wrong, but it's so nice when you realize that, you know, especially like with a moose or an elk, they're such big animals. You need your ammunition to perform beautifully. And I got into long-range shooting about 3 years ago. I've trained with some of the best sniper champions, world champions. They all use Nosler as well. And it just, when you can take out, you know, a lot of things can grow on you. And, of course, you need to plug in all your ballistics, and you've got wind and altitude and all these things. But when you have ammo that you can count on to perform the way it's supposed to, and, you know, when it says it's, you know, their ballistics are what they say it is, it's just a beautiful thing.
It takes out one of those nagging variables, whether the weather, the, you know, that's so great. Speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV about Nosler. So let's shift gear a little bit and talk a little bit about what's going on with Skullbound. How long have you been doing the show?
We are airing season five right now. It's amazing.
Cool.
I'm so blessed.
So going from when you started to now, did you ever think that this would be happening?
I really didn't. I did not. I didn't foresee the success that it would have, and we just feel so blessed that things have come together the way they have. Our hunts have gone well. I feel even more lucky to have the platform for my personal conservation causes, because conservation is a very passionate topic to me. We always include a conservation piece on every episode, but it's also given me the platform to start taking veterans out hunting, and it's been seriously some of the most fulfilling moments of my life. I took another Army veteran double amputee out this year on his first elk hunt, and he got his bull on day two, and there were tears all around. And I have to say, When I told Nosler that I was taking another Army hero out, they built him the gun. They gave him the ammo. You know, they have been such a tremendous supporter of Skullbound TV and our veterans, and it just is one more reason I'm so proud to be partnered with them.
And it's something I've been following, too. We've had you on before with Cam a number of times talking about that. I follow it on social media. It's so great that you do that. And isn't it great to have it's a great agenda to have to begin with, you ask me, but to have a vehicle like this, you know.
Yeah.
Some of us are very lucky and blessed that we get to do what we do.
Right.
And to me, you're doing such great work. So,
well, it's a way to say thank you. And, you know, here I am in a woman in the greatest country in the world. I'm able to pursue my dreams, and I'm able to, you know, have a house full of guns, if you will, because of these men and women. And it's just a way to give back to them. And it's a wonderful platform to have that we don't take lightly.
Jenna Waller, how can we get more information about you? Where do we got to go?
You can go to skullboundtv.com. Super simple. We also have a lot of information on the Sportsman's Channel website, but we're on Big Game Wednesday nights. I'm happy to be a part of this industry.
Jenna Waller, thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Mr. Kurt Schlichter joining us on the program. You can find him, of course, online at Kurt Schlichter. He is probably riling up somebody. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, man. It's kind of depressing, you know?
It is kind of depressing.
I'm pretty depressed that Prince has passed on. I think I was also depressed that he was 57.
Yeah. Yesterday I came home to my wife being very depressed that Tim Curry was 70. That was her depressing news yesterday. I know.
I think he wants to do the time warp again.
Time does march on, unfortunately. Yeah, you're right. But 57, that is way too young. And you know, I said earlier in the show, I mean, this might be one of the last big like shared cultural moments for people. And even then, I will be honest with you, there are staffers here at NRA News who shall remain nameless who said who when they learned that Prince had passed away today.
Yeah, I mean, I distinctly remember parking cars for Dollar Rent-A-Car at San Francisco International Airport, and that was summer of 84, I believe, and, Doves Cry and all the others were big, you know, on the radio all the time. And it was just, I wouldn't call myself a giant Prince fan, but, you know, I know he was, my friends who play guitar tell me he was just an amazing artist. He just could do amazing things. And it's just kind of sad.
It is kind of sad. So I'm a little bit younger than you are, so I was not old enough to drive when Purple Rain came out. And so my Purple Rain story was, this was the first album, and it was an album that I bought that my mom actually kind of listened to, like overheard, and was like, what are you listening to? Because Purple Rain, you know, when you're 10, you know, Darling Nikki and...
There's some things on there that are a little controversial.
Right. Tipper Gore was not too pleased with the Purple Rain soundtrack way back when. And so that was... I remember having that conversation with my mom, actually. That was my first exposure to Prince, was I shouldn't listen to Prince because I wasn't old enough to listen to Prince. Now I am. So I'll be listening to the Purple Rain soundtrack on the way home. This is sort of, again, I mean, this is the big news story. And I saw, I think it was Gabriel Malore on Twitter, responding to a question about, you know, why this was such a big story. And he said, A, because Prince mattered to a lot of people, and B, everybody is desperate to talk about anything other than the election.
Well, those are both true. You know, especially if you're a member of the party formerly known as the Republicans. The only good news we've had in the last couple of days is when the founder of the modern Democrat Party, Andrew Jackson, has been kicked off the $20 bill in favor of a minority woman who used her Second Amendment rights to protect herself from tyranny, which I think is just, I think that's just tremendous. I am so happy.
So you saw the story, I'm sure, at Salon saying that you can't be happy, right? That apparently there are all sorts of conservatives who are wailing and gnashing their teeth over this. I haven't seen it.
Who is that guy?
Right?
He's a conservative who's like, you know what I hate? People who use weapons to defend themselves against tyranny.
Yeah,
that doesn't seem like a big concern. That's not part of the conservative movement I've experienced.
Right. Now, I did see somebody today say something like, well, if constitutional carry was good enough for Harriet Tubman, it's good enough for me. And so I did have to point out that at the time, there were some states in the country that had these, quote unquote, common sense gun safety laws that that forbade people like Harriet Tubman from actually legally carrying a firearm. So,
well, exactly. I mean, a lot of the basis of gun control was an attempt by people to keep members of minorities, oppressed and down. And I think, you know, the inspirational stories of particularly Black Americans who used their God-given right to keep and bear arms, because the Constitution doesn't give us any rights, Cam. Mm-hmm. It just recognizes the rights that we were born with, to protect themselves and their family from people who wanted to murder them and oppress them and humiliate them. They're inspirational.
I'll tell you what, if you've not read the book, Professor Nicholas Johnson at Fordham came out with a book. It's probably been like 3 years ago now, called Negroes and the Gun, the Black Tradition of Arms in America. And it is fantastic. And he starts, you know, right from the before the beginning of this nation on through the civil rights era. And it's a history that, frankly, you know, Hillary Clinton will never talk about this history.
No. Nope.
She I would imagine, would refuse to acknowledge that this book has ever even been written. You won't find a lot of people talking about this history, and it's a damn shame, because these are some incredible stories, you know, from our shared national history.
Absolutely. It's funny. Just the other day was the anniversary of Concord and Lexington, which, of course, mm-hmm. sparked the Revolutionary War when the Brits decided they were going to disarm Americans, a important lesson for future tyrants. And that history is largely being whitewashed from the history books. People don't want to talk about it. So it's up to folks like us. Because I'll tell you, my kids know that history.
My kids do, too.
My kids know the history of resistance to tyranny. That is in our blood as Americans and from our family.
But I saw you engaging in a conversation earlier today with someone online, and it seems to me like you're running across more and more the attitude of, in this particular case, Lexington and Concord. Let's say the argument would be, Kurt, it didn't really matter because it was just, you know, one group of oppressive white guys fighting another group of oppressive white guys, and ultimately what they built was crap, and we would have been better off, you know, had America never existed in the first place.
Yeah, you know, nothing says oppression like New England farmers. Yeah, that's, you know, the scourge of freedom. There are a lot of people who would like to rewrite history or like to live in the present and, you know, look back and apply the same standards to the past. No, I'm not talking about whitewashing history. I am talking about, I'm not going to walk around in guilt because, you know, Europeans came over to North America and conquered it, which they did. That doesn't in any way, you know, diminish the courage of Native Americans who, you know, served in our military and all the rest. Nor the legacy of the Native American warriors who fought the United States Army,
yeah,
and then were absorbed into its legacy as they distinguished themselves as members of it. I remember a very moving ceremony. I was invited to, I can't even pronounce this, like Halushka or Harushka. It's a Native American ceremony of warriors, and they were in their warrior dress, but besides their Native American insignia,
all of them had American military insignia. All of them were American military vets, and they shared that that legacy. And I was just as proud as I could be. I just thought it was the coolest thing ever.
That is cool. But the thing is, you know, you're talking to people A, who've never done that. B, they've never been in the military themselves in many of these cases. But, you know, they have this. There's, I don't know if you read the piece at Vox today talking about the smugness of the American liberal. But there is this attitude.
I should finally a reason to read Vox.
I know, right? I mean, seriously.
What were the chances?
It's once in like 3 years. Yeah, I think this is the first time I've ever said, you should read this piece at Vox, Kurt. But
there's a really good article in Daily Kos. Media Matters really makes you think today.
I haven't gotten that far yet. It's not that bizarro world, buddy. But this piece at Vox talks about the smugness of knowing, right, where there's this attitude that is evinced on the left in many cases of there's no real knowledge, but they know what they're supposed to know. Right, and they know what the correct point of view to have is.
Yeah, I like how they construct a complete moral system. Why deny? You know, there's a lot of fashionable atheists, especially where I am. I actually did a panel in Hollywood a couple weeks. I think we talked about it,
mm-hmm.
And I said, "Look, I know you guys haven't met a conservative veteran who actually believes in God." And the host said, "Well, that's interesting. Anyone else here believe in God?" It was me and Arena, and like 50 other people were looking at us like we were crazy. So I'm thinking, okay, you don't believe in God. That's your business, and I'm not going to screw with you. I'm just wondering how you have all these moral certainties. Where did you get them? Why is it a moral certainty my daughter has to go to the bathroom with a dude in a dress? Where is that written somewhere, or did you just kind of decide you like that idea and it became a moral principle?
I'm curious. But see, this is the crux of the issue here is that there is this moral certainty that they are the most enlightened, wisest, smartest generation to ever walk the face of the earth. You know, I'm honestly kind of surprised you didn't see any pushback about Harriet Tubman appearing on the $20 bill because, you know, Harriet Tubman was not supportive of LGBT issues. You know, I mean, like you can.
I know her record on trans. She was totally cisgendered.
Right.
And she rejected safe spaces. In fact, she looked for unsafe spaces, you know, in order to free people, which, you know, really makes people whose entire agenda is simply to pose as agents of justice. It kind of embarrasses them and it's hurtful and they're in fear because she humiliates them because she's the real freaking deal and they're just posers. Until you want a social justice warrior? That's Harriet Tubman. That's Harriet Tubman. She risks something. She risked something. You know, the worst that's going to happen to these guys is, you know, they miss too many shifts at Starbucks. They get fired and they have to go next door to Pete's.
Well, look what happened at the Ohio State University like 2 weeks ago, where students had occupied the administration building for a matter of several hours, and then the university president told them, look, we're going to arrest you for trespassing if you're still here at midnight.
Yeah,
and,
get out.
And that was a choice for these students to make. You know, there have been plenty, as you say, there have been plenty of people who have risked arrest. There have been plenty of individuals in American history who have actually, you know, engaged in civil disobedience and have been arrested in order to make a protest and to show the world what they believe in. But these precious snowflakes, they packed up when it became clear that the president meant what he said. They didn't want to risk an arrest. They didn't want to go to jail for a couple of hours over whatever their demands were.
No, and they didn't want to get expelled from school.
Look,
just because you're willing to get arrested doesn't make you right, but it does show that you're committed to something beyond posing. And my favorite part was when the dean wouldn't talk to these idiots. He sent some minion, and the guy says, look, as far as your demands, the dean doesn't take demands from students. He'll talk to you. He'll always talk to you, and you should talk to him. Demands? I don't do demands. I love that. More people ought to do it.
I think that we will actually see more of this coming.
We will.
The latest story, I don't know if you saw, I meant to talk about this today, but apparently there's they're now topless protests on campus, Kurt, so that's happening now, too.
Topless campus protests?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's probably the guys.
just for you, Kurt.
The people who threaten topless protests are never the kind of people you want to call on that. You know, it's never, I'll take the challenge. No, it's like, oh, God, I give in.
Do you think that...
you're going to ruin me for breath. God, you're a festival of body hair.
Yeah, right. Well, this is...
Like Ernest Borgnine.
So I call this my theory of public nudity, and that is the less interested you are in seeing somebody naked, the more likely they are to get naked in public.
I think that, you know, Stephen Hawking did a lot of pioneering work on that formula. And it took up several chalkboards to get the
numbers exactly right. But
exactly.
I think that's the case.
It's spooky how it works.
All right, so we've only got about a minute left here before we go. You know, of course, in California that they are still... Kurt, trying to pass gun control laws both at the legislative level, and then we've got this referendum that Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom is pushing here. Are you a little concerned about the where California is going in terms of the right to keep and bear arms?
Well, I think California is regressing where the rest of the country is progressing. If I believed in the rule of law anymore, I would think that the courts would toss these out as manifestly designed to infringe on the right to keep and bear arms. Sadly, this sort of gratuitous poking at law-abiding citizens increases disrespect for the law, increases anger and bitterness, and will likely, on the plus side, it'll likely motivate more voters in California. California is a disaster on many grounds. The crime rate's up, the success rate is down. I think there's going to be an accounting at some point. And I think stupid people, and Gavin Newsom is one of the dumbest people in America. He is a fool. He is just not a smart man. Jerry Brown is. He vetoed a lot of laws. Because he understood that their overall effect was simply to outrage normal people. But Gavin Newsom is stupid and vindictive, like Hillary Clinton is. And I think he's going to cause problems. And we'll see what happens.
All right, buddy. Listen, we are out of time. Thank you very much for coming on the show. It is always good talking with you, and we will do this again very soon.
Excellent.
All right. And no charge for this, right? Yeah, I know you bill by the hour normally, but all right, that works for me. Thank you, buddy. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.
Kurt Schlichter here on NRA News, Cam and Company. The music means it is time for us to say goodbye, but the good news is it's only Thursday. So we'll be back tomorrow as well, live 2 p.m. Eastern on NRANews.com, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific on SiriusXM Patriot 125, right after the David Webb Show, on demand all the time. Through iHeartRadio and on iTunes, and of course the Roku app for NRA News as well. Have a great rest of your day. We'll see you here soon with more. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosworth.